Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the new action film Revenge, now available in theaters and on demand. Jen is enjoying a romantic getaway with her wealthy boyfriend, which is suddenly disrupted when his sleazy friends arrive for an unannounced hunting trip. Tension mounts in the house until the situation abruptly and viciously intensifies, culminating in a shocking act that leaves Jen left for dead. Unfortunately for her assailants, Jen survives and reemerges with a relentless, wrathful intent. Revenge. Declared a beautiful, brutal revelation and awarded a perfect 10 out of 10 by Screen Crush, Revenge is a razor-sharp feminist subversion of the revenge thriller and a must-see film. It is in theaters and on demand now.
Tonight's episode is also brought to you by the Horror Movie Night podcast. Every week, brothers Matt and Brian and their best friend Scott watch a different questionable horror film. Ranging from forgotten low-budget films like The Uninvited or Invisible Maniac, cult classics like Sleepwalkers, or beloved films like The Gate and Halloween 3, Horror Movie Night has definitely discussed one of your favorite horror movies. Whether they are hypothesizing about the coke-fueled writing session for the brain or lamenting about how as adults they will never be as cool as Rudy and Monster Squad, they lovingly dissect horror movies with the precision of Dr. Giggles. Listen for yourself at hmnpodcast.com. Additionally, this month, on June 23rd, the podcast will celebrate its 150th episode. To do so, they will be hosting a 12-hour horror movie Twitch stream marathon to raise money for Planned Parenthood. The trio will watch and commentate over eight of their favorite films starting at noon Eastern, live at twitch.tv/geekscapetv. So please check out the Horror Movie Night podcast.
The Shockwaves team is thrilled to be involved in the Stephanie Rothman Fellowship for Female Film Students. The fund focuses on film students who identify as female and who want to make horror, science fiction, action, and fantasy, and thriller movies. The fund is presented by the Shockwaves podcast and A Theory of Film Night and was created by Shockwaves' very own Rebecca McKenzie, who I can see right now. Our goal is to give away $5,000 to a female film student each year. We're in the final push of a fundraising goal and need to raise about $1,500 more. Please help us, Shockers. We are posting the donation link on our Facebook and Twitter, and we'll also post it on the Shockwaves fan club Facebook page. Every little bit helps. Even if you can only send $5, that will help us reach our goal to support diverse voices in the horror industry. If you send $1,500, this will be a lot quicker. Please find us on socials for the donation link, and we thank you so much for helping us support women in genre films.
The Shockwaves crew is super excited to announce that we are heading to the Mad Monster Party convention in Phoenix this July. This amazing convention runs from July 13th to the 15th at the Wekopa Resort, just outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mad Monster has some amazing guests lined up like Robert Englund, Kane Hodder, Lance Henriksen, plus a ton of guests from the entire Elm Street franchise. And the Shockwaves team, minus myself, Mr. Ryan Turek, will be there doing a live show. Check out madmonster.com for more info, and we can't wait to see you in Arizona. And while you're there, touch Onyx's face.
Just touch it. Just touch it.
You're going down, Turek.
All right, here we are. Welcome to episode number 99 of Shockwaves.
Woo!
Wow. This is almost a landmark.
We are almost
99.
There.
99.
That's pretty crazy. Baby. Yeah, yeah.
99.
I posted that old killer POV Bloodcast crossover picture this weekend.
Wow. I was
to get
so
us ready.
Pregnant yeah. in that picture. Yep. It was below the table,
so
but I just looked at my face and I was like, I am so pregnant.
Pregnant
there.
With anticipation of this day.
Of yes. this.
Many and a lot of beer.
To come.
A lot of people said they missed the beer. That there's a lot less beer
the
these
drive
days.
To the Blumhouse office wasn't as, yeah. as drastic
but
as Geek Nation.
I'm going
to
call it now. We're going to have beer at that episode. 100. 100, I'm going to bring some beer.
Great.
Cool.
Okay.
Maybe we should have and our friends at Phantom Carriage bring us a...
Hey!
Yeah. Oh,
there we
go. Hey, that's
well,
a good
we only
plan.
Have 2 days to organize this.
I know, guys.
By all means,
we don't
we
have
will take
long.
Sponsorships left or right. Give yes. us the
but
free beer.
We get tons of requests for drunken debates. And I'm going to talk about how when I was at Phoenix last weekend, I was on a panel for Bold Horror Statements, and it made me miss the drunken debates, guys.
First of all, so, Becca, you don't drink during
I know,
any of them.
But I
never
did during the drunken debates. I drank a ton of Jack Daniels during that one.
Fair enough.
I do like that there was a... a panel called, what was it?
Bold Horror Statement.
Bold Horror Statement.
I'll talk about it.
That's our entire
bold
show.
It's like hot takes.
All right, cast of characters. I'm Rob Galuzzo. This is Elric Kane sitting
Howdy.
Next to me. Hi. Ryan Turek is with us.
Hi.
And Rebecca McKendry.
Hello.
So
see how efficient
here.
We've gotten in 99 episodes? That's just like we're on it now.
Yeah, we're on top of it. Yeah, lots to talk about. Where do we begin?
Well, I'll
we've
jump
got
in.
Stuff to plug.
Oh. I'll jump in with Phoenix Comic Con just because I was just there and I just talked about it. So I was at, it's no longer called Phoenix Comic Con because guess what, guys? San Diego Comic Con sued everybody.
Oh.
So then it became Phoenix Comic Fest.
Fest doesn't sound as.
I know, and they're changing it to Phoenix Comic Fusion next year. So regardless, I was at a really big fucking convention in Phoenix that I've done for the past several years, and I absolutely love this show.
So Comic-Con like trademarked the word Comic-Con?
Comic-Con, which is crazy because I was like, it's literally the word convention. They trademark con and sued everybody. So fine.
Wow.
So everybody has to change their name and kowtow to them. But that said, so I was at what is currently Phoenix Comic Fest, soon to become Fusion. Really, really big show in Phoenix, and it's awesome, and they have really good horror panels, and it was just an amazing weekend to begin with. I was on a lot of panels, but the one that I had the most fun with by far was Bold Horror Statements.
One of them was
Zelda is the scariest monster ever in cinematic history.
Okay,
Pet Cemetery.
Bold. I mean, not true, but scary.
Scary. One of mine was that Exorcist 3 is scarier than the original Exorcist.
Also a cool statement, not true.
Oh, come on.
Could I have come to this panel to be the naysayer?
Okay. I'll do. And then, so what we had is you would say your statement, and then you would have like a couple of minutes to say why you believe this, and then the audience would have to cheer or boo.
Oh, I like that. That's actually
so
fun.
So the audience had to decide whether you were like completely full of it. So the audience, I got the Exorcist 3 one. Like, people were in with me on the Exorcist 3. The one that I lost him was Paris Hilton does not suck in horror films.
House of Wax, she's
House
awesome.
Of Wax, I know. Repo the Genetic Opera, and I don't hate Nine Lives either. Those are the three horror films she's done.
I haven't even seen that. No, you got booed. Becca just got booed. Thumbs down.
I just scraped Nine Lives off my heel.
Oh,
I mean, like, you were, how dare you tarnish episode 99 with some rando direct-to-video movie.
Nine Lives is not great. I don't hate it, but it's not great. But seriously, like, House of Wax and her performance in Repo the Genetic Opera, in both she plays the person that you hate and you want to die, and she's really good at that. So that was one of my bold statements. So literally there was three of us, and we each brought like six bold horror statements to the table, which was a lot of fun. And then there was also, and I didn't even know this was a thing, there was a convention comedy show where they bring in comedians who have like specific genres or topics that they focus on. So like one person just focused on comic books, and a guy who comes to horror trivia with us, Kyle Clark, and his was so niche about the horror genre. It was just amazing. So that was definitely one of my highlights as well. I met a ton of Shockwaves listeners. So it was great seeing everybody there. Everyone wanted to touch Elric's face. So be prepared for that.
When we go back to Mad
Monster. And thank you, Monty and AJ, for just a generally awesome weekend.
Wow.
Well, sounds like a blast.
Man, you're a jet setter.
Bold horror statement.
I've got one. A bold horror statement. You ready?
I'm ready.
You're going to love it. Zombie 5 is better than Zombie 4. Hurrah.
Where did you watch Zombie 5?
Okay, so one of the two Super Dark Times writer, Luke Petrowski, I was at his house yesterday for a barbecue, looked on a shelf, and he had a DVD box set that was Zombie 3, 4, 5.
You know what? I have that too. I totally have Zombie 5.
And it's a great coffee.
I forgot I had it.
Is that the bird
it's
one?
It's Killing Birds. And here's the fun part. I was kind of like, you know, I'm just doing this because it's opportunistic and I wanted to complete this thing that I had gunned myself into. And I really didn't think 4 was very interesting at all and thought it was quite flat. 5 is not a good movie, but it is really close to being like a Fulci film. That's what's interesting about it. It really feels like a Fulci film. Some of the zombie moments, which are kind of tacked on to the end, feel like it. It was shot not as a part of the saga.
Yeah.
It was shot just as a regular film. It was meant to be directed by Michel Sauvy right after Stage Fright. He pulled out to do The Church. Then I think Bob was meant to do it. He pulled out. And so they went with the Stage Fright, I guess it was the assistant director. It pains me
that Michel Sauvy was going to follow up Stage Fright with Zombie 5.
Well, it wasn't Zombie 5. I don't know what it was called. But it was produced and shot. This is quality. Joe D'Amato was the cinematographer and producer of this movie.
So is it neither porn nor horror, but somehow...
This isn't Sean Newell. So it's the first American shot zombie film in that series besides Fulci's. So that's cool. They come back, so it's all shot in New Orleans. But I will say, I think Ryan would actually, the first 5 minutes is like The Prowler. It opens like a real, a guy comes back from the war to find out his wife is in bed with another guy. So he like murders them, and then other people come with the baby and he murders everyone except the baby. But it's shot all really like actually a good slasher film.
Wow.
But the crazy thing is the famous like Westerns actor, Robert Vaughn,
he's
like a really big actor. He is in this movie and he plays that character, the killer. Grown up and blind with bad, you know, bleeding eyes, and it's really strange. But here's the fun part: there's nothing with birds in this movie. I mean, nothing with birds. The birds are in an opening scene where a guy slashes someone. The birds are watching. There are no killing birds in this movie. I was expecting it to be like a part three.
Yeah, even the cover has a giant.
Let me put it this way: there is no virus. There is no. They peck the killer's eyes out at the start in the opening scene. That's it.
So
those coming in for the bird horror are going to be sorely disappointed. Those coming in going, this is going to be the shittiest movie ever because 4 was so stupid, are going to be pleasantly surprised like I was.
What was pulling people to Zombie 5 was the intent of bird horror.
I think so. I think it could have been. There's lots of fogging of the lens. This is one of those horror periods where you're like, oh my God, where do you even find this foggy a lens? But but the problem is there's long stretches where nothing, it's like these kids go down to find some scientist. They are at a house. It's more of a, to be honest, let me put it this way. This film would make more sense as an Amityville sequel. You could have just plugged and played as just called it Amityville whatever, and it would have probably made more sense than being necessarily a zombie sequel. And at a certain point, zombies start coming, but you never find out who they were,
right.
Who they were, or why. And there's none of that military stuff, none of that voodoo stuff.
None of that.
So it's radically different.
Nonsense.
Interesting.
I think this film actually would, if you're going to watch them in order, I'd put it actually after 2, like Fulci's Zombie. I think it would feel the most like that, but it's not set there.
And then
I genuinely kind of liked it.
Your order to watch them is Zombie, then this one.
It might be, yeah, and then go to the two island ones. Just because the island ones are kind of together a pair.
Okay.
But like for anyone who can get the box set, I think if you're completing this, I definitely liked it more than 4, and because 4 is just too camp for me. This is not camp. That's the other thing. This is kind of straight horror. And it is boring at times. It's a bunch of teens hanging out at a house, but the actual zombie scenes literally look like the zombies from House by the Cemetery and things like that. You know, when they're really old-looking faces.
Oatmeal.
And yeah, oatmeal. And there's a scene
oatmeal
where they...
and you know,
powdery.
Gorilla glue.
Yeah. But I love that. I find that to be what I think of as a creepy zombie. They're unnerving.
Is Severin doing part 5 on Blue?
I think Rob tried to ask them about that.
I mentioned it to David Gregory. He's like, I don't know about that. I'm like, come on. You're going to do 3 and 4, but you're not going to do 5?
Yeah, I want to get
all the questionable things you put out.
I mean, I think this one's better, so I'd be curious to hear why he doesn't maybe like this one.
Yeah.
But there's an interview on the extras with Robert Vaughn, this classy actor talking about this movie. And you're like, so weird.
Robert Vaughn did a lot of weird career choices.
Probably towards the end.
Yeah.
But he's in like Magnificent 7 and stuff, so it's kind of crazy. Yeah. But I thought it was fun, man. I got to say, I kind of enjoyed it.
Excellent. I do have this DVD, and you can find it on Amazon. But it'd be nice if somebody does.
The bar was
Severin,
low.
Come on.
Yeah, Severin has to kind of come through for us. Don't leave us hanging.
Can I throw out a bold horror statement?
Bold horror statements.
Holy crap.
I have seen the greatest film about a demon snake that has a telepathic link to Oliver Reed ever.
Oh, my gosh.
Is Klaus
that
in there?
Film
this
is called
Klaus.
Spasms.
Oh,
Spasm.
Yeah.
From 1983. No, not Venom.
Wow, so he's got some experience with snakes.
But Spasms is good, too, because it's got a lot of like crazy overlay effect is how they do most of the special effects in it.
But let me tell you, Spasms is a much more enjoyable film than Venom.
Venom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Venom's
there's a lot more going for it. This film was directed by William Frewitt, who did Blue Monkey.
I love Blue Monkey.
Becca loves herself some
Canadian
Blue Monkey.
Exploitation.
Any of the three of you guys seen Blue Monkey?
No.
Nope. I've seen other William Frewitt movies.
Giant insects takes over a hospital ward, guys.
Yeah.
Or actually, I think it might be a plant, but it looks like an insect.
Knowing
anyway,
that,
proceed.
Knowing that, let me tell you a little bit about Spasms. So Oliver Reed plays this rich dude that had an encounter with a demon serpent on a remote island, and he got bit by this thing, but he didn't die. He survived the attack. And several years later, he learned this. Apparently, through research, he discovered that the serpent surfaces on this island every several years. So he sent a crackerjack team of explorers to capture this beast, then bring it back to the U.S. so he could face it one more time. So they succeed. A bunch of villagers die in the process. He brings the serpent back to the U.S. And it's like, it's in a cage in some university where Peter Fonda is teaching ESP.
Why don't you lead with that?
Yeah.
You had
because you lead with Oliver Reed, okay, not Henry Fonda.
Peter Fonda is smaller in the film, if I remember correctly.
What's that?
He's not in the film.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's Peter Fonda.
Yeah.
Peter Fonda. Sorry. I'm Henry Fonda, whatever. Peter Fonda. So what happens is this satanic snake cult that comes into the first 45 minutes of the film and then doesn't really resurface at all through the rest of the movie accidentally sets this demon serpent free, and the demon serpent runs loose. And every time it attacks people, Oliver Reed, because he's got a telepathic link to it, he could see the deaths. Mm. And so one by one, the serpent starts taking people out and it bites people. And then you get these glorious bladder effects occur where the skin starts to split and then your skin gets all frayed and then you die. Violently.
It's like the eye with a snake.
Okay. It is. It's a pretty very special. It's a very special film.
That sounds better than Zombie 5. I'm now questioning my bold statement.
So what you get from this is you get a lot of POV of the demon serpent, which is usually in a blue hue. You get co-ed deaths. There's a little bit of an exploitation element to this film. You get a scene in which the serpent snakes its way through a park full of people and you don't know if it's going to kill them or not. And then you get a hasty third act in which Oliver Reed takes on the demon serpent with Peter Fonda. And
I remember a giant bonfire for some reason.
That's at the very beginning of the film.
Okay.
It's the very beginning of the film. But this is a film that I remember seeing on the cover of Fangoria because it had one of the split dudes, like, you know, with his skin all bloated and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, that must be a movie about people getting a disease and they just explode. No, it's about a demon serpent.
Huh.
Wow. Code Red put out the Blu-ray. Looks very beautiful. Nice. Tangerine Dream did a portion of the score.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. I wonder if it's like repurposed.
Spasms. Yeah, I don't know. But anyways, check out Spasms. It's incredibly special. I think it's a great Monster Hunt movie.
Sound guy should be like really like losing it at you right now. Every time you make a bold statement, your hand's smashing on the desk.
Bold horror statements.
Our sound guy's totally asleep. He's just like, he's cut out. He's out of it.
Rob, you got any bold horror
statements?
That cover is
Spasms.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking it up on RoninFlix.com is where you can get your Code
Which
Red stuff.
Yes.
I did have a bold statement. My bold statement is, believe it or not, Ryan and I would encourage you to watch the longer version of Bloodhook and not the truncated, edited one.
Wow.
It's on Amazon Prime and out there.
Apparently, wait, you guys watched Bloodhook a second time just because the director's cut was too enticing?
No. I would not watch it again. But people have been reporting back to us that the version that's online is
the Amazon.
A truncated version. And I guess Troma put it out that way too. Hmm. To me, I don't know if it would have the WTF factor had it not been as absurdly long as
it was. This might be a problem with Amazon, because this happened when I showed Dick Don't Go in the House. And I was so excited to show it to him. He hadn't seen it. And it cut out all the nudity, her burning, none of it was in it. And it was a cut that Code Red had put up there. Mm. And it was like totally ruins the movie because it takes out the most sordid details.
Yeah.
So maybe there is an issue with some. I wish there was some sort of user guide to
Amazon. If you're looking
at. We need a good nerd.
If you're really going to start a new horror site, it should be which version to watch.
Yeah.
Because you were telling me about Scalpel.
Yep, Blood Rage.
There's two
Blood Rage has different versions.
So that it'd be good to navigate.
Kathy's Curse, you're probably
better off with the short
incoherent
cut.
Definitely go with incoherent.
Yeah, exactly.
What would Brian Collins say?
Yeah.
I think he.
What's he know?
He sides with the shorter cut.
I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. That's my one of my bold statements. But the other one, in terms of things I've watched, is I finally caught up with something that has been kind of notorious for many, many years for many, many reasons that I just assumed I would probably dislike strongly. And my bold statement is, yes, I was correct. I very much dislike this movie, but it's still worth talking about, and that is the Poughkeepsie Tapes.
Somebody told me recently they dug it when they started. I still haven't seen
it. It's an ugly film.
Yeah, and I guess that's what it is. Well, first of all, it depends what kind of horror fan you are, because this was made way back in 2007, you know, kind of at the height of the found footage thing, or, you know, they were just making so many different types of found footage movies.
It was also just coming off the torture porn.
Yeah,
era.
For the most part. So it very much embodies, it's the found footage version reaction to that, which is basically, you know, it's a serial killer. Basically, you know, it's set up as a mock documentary about a serial killer who targets all different types of people, whether they be little girls or teenage girls or couples or whatever. It's just nasty stuff, like a Henry style killer. And so they found all his tapes, and so basically this is kind of a faux documentary where you watch some of his tapes back and that kind of stuff. And it's interestingly put together. It's the first film from the Dowdle brothers. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's so interesting is because it and the special features are what really make the movie itself, because I'm sick of found footage. And quite frankly, I just don't want to watch women get tortured for long periods of time, which is a lot of what this movie is.
It's about experiments for some reason, like crazy weird.
No, nothing like that at all. Just a guy that kidnaps women and kills little girls and just terrible, terrible shit that I'm like, why am I watching this?
Yeah.
And I was waiting for some sort of cathartic or maybe interesting kind of ending to it, and it's not. It's just a downer from start to finish. But it had all this attention when it was, doing the festival circuit, and then it just disappeared. And so for years, this was kind of a bootleg title. It's like, oh, have you seen the picture? It's really fucked up. You have to see this movie. And so finally, Scream Factory got the rights and put it out last year on a Blu-ray. And the Dowdle brothers have gone on to do – they did The Quarantine, which is the remake – the very inferior remake of Wreck. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I do kind of dig that they did was Devil.
I like Devil a lot.
It was based on a story by M. Night Shyamalan, and he produced it. But they wrote and directed that feature, which I liked because it felt like a Twilight Zone, and it's
tight little film,
like 65 minutes long or something. It's like ridiculously short, and so that's kind of cool. But I guess what's interesting is this in context. So I watched the interview with them on it, and what happened, and this is totally true, is they had a very successful screening at Tribeca.
I was at that screening.
You were at it.
I was at it. I was at, I saw Poughkeepsie Tapes at Tribeca Film Festival in 2000. I guess it was 2007. And the audience went nuts. And I've never been a big fan of the tortury stuff, but found footage was just kind of coming onto its own at the time. And so it was really cutting edge. It was like something I'd never seen before at the time. I've since seen lots of versions of both of it. But yeah, it was like that particular screening, the audience was going nuts.
Yeah. And they had made it independently, like all on their own, low budget sort of deal. So it premieres at Tribeca. There's sold out screenings, huge bidding war. MGM buys the movie for a shit ton of money. Mm-hmm. And then while that's happening, before it even comes out, they get hired to do Quarantine on the basis of like, oh, there's all this press or whatever. Then they make the mistake, or it's not them. The way they explain it is actually really funny, is they make the mistake, or MGM made the mistake of sending it to Butnumathon, Ain't It Cool, in Austin. Mm. And presenting as if it was a real movie, a real documentary. Hmm. And the audience turned on them just because they were trying to sell it as a real documentary. And one of them was there, and he explains on the special features, he's like, MGM barred us from doing Q&As because they wanted to sort of sell it as a real thing. It's like, we would have never, like...
Yeah, it's like Cannibal Holocaust where they had to sign the writer.
We would have absolutely been like, oh no, obviously it's fictional, in the same way that Blair Witch was fictional, but they didn't really lead on to it too much. But he's like, so it was even worse. He's like, I was sitting there and they turned like right away. And then at the end, the story was he was too scared to do the Q&A. Whatever. He's like, no, I was legally not allowed to talk and take credit for the movie after. Oh. It's like, but they're like, but we were in the middle of making Quarantine. So, had they not gotten that gig, it would have completely destroyed their career right off the bat. But they were smart in that as soon as it got this bidding war and sold for a lot of money, they immediately set up their first studio project. And et cetera. And so the story behind it is more fascinating than anything. There are some creepy moments to it in general, but it's just a nasty movie that I just personally don't like at all.
Yeah.
But if
what was the reason it was so difficult to see all these years? No one wanted to put it out? Was there a rights issue with putting it out?
No, there's no rights. Just MGM got cold feet. And nobody, they will never say this, but I hear it's because of how disastrous that Austin. They even think that because of how disastrously they turned. And I mean, they were planning a like 2000 theater rollout sort of big release. And I think even they were like, I don't know what they were thinking. Like, that's a lot of screens for a low budget movie. Mm. And then, to try to sell it to an audience is a real thing. And it's a little bit nastier than what would be considered a commercial big release.
At the time, it didn't feel that much nastier because this was like right around Hostel 2.
Yeah.
And it's definitely Soft War with the Autopsy. Like, it was definitely, we were kind of at the height of like really nasty shit happening.
And found footage would have been more exciting then, a little bit more. Like
a little bit. I guess at the time it would have been.
Devil Inside, anything before that. That to me was the end of that, you know, run.
Yeah, this is definitely a product of its time. And now I'm not a big fan of it now, but, you know, if you're into found footage and just curious at what the fuss was about back then, Poughkeepsie Tapes, Scream Factory put it out.
Nice. Okay, well, a number of people from the Shockwaves fan group online know how much I love Cyan Sano, so I started getting all these messages about how I needed to watch his new miniseries on Amazon, which is called Tokyo Vampire Hotel.
Oh, that's in my queue. I want to
see it. It is fucking nuts. I love this. It is like one of the best things I've seen in a long time, and I don't recommend this to everyone. It is ultraviolet, hyperviolet, like literally opens with one of the greatest, most violent scenes I have seen in a long time. But if you watch a lot of Cyan Sano, you kind of know what you're getting into begin with. Amazing cinematography. I really have no clue what is going on. They set up the plot and then they kill a bunch of people and it's just glorious looking. There's, from what I can get, and I just finished the fourth episode, there are two different warring factions of vampires. One is the Dracula clan, and then the other one is like the Coven clan. And they are warring back and forth. No, it's not Coven.
Did you say Coven?
It's Corvin. Thank you. I was like, there's an I in there somewhere. So there's two warring vampire families that are both kind of targeting this girl who has just turned 22nd, and there's something celestial with her birthday and why they're targeting her. And then there's also this guy who runs a hotel who keeps luring guests there so he can kill them, and he is establishing that the next day, and this is kind of leading up to it, that the next day is going to be the end of the world. And you don't really know how it's going to end, you just know that there's all this crazy shit going on with vampires and then this guy who owns a hotel who keeps killing people. I love this show. It is batshit crazy. Again, opening scene is just amazing, but Cold Fish, Strange Circus, Tag, like, I have been with Cyan Sano through all of his stuff so far, 100%, and this is just, like, upped the ante. The cinematography is amazing in it. It is on streaming on Amazon Prime right now. Six to eight episodes. It's short, and you can feel that because it's definitely leading up to this end of the world thing, which is, you know, it's kind of counting down hour by hour to it.
Yeah.
So, Tokyo Vampire Hotel
on Amazon Prime. Beautiful. What else you guys got?
I got a few.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I watched 1989's Dark Tower by Freddie Francis and Ken Wiederhorn, who both took a pseudonym under the joint pseudonym of Ken Barnett.
Oh, weird.
And I saw you post a VHS of this, but I've never even heard of it.
I bought it on VHS as part of the upcoming Slashback initiative, and it is such a drag.
Yeah,
and it's a bummer for a movie that begins pretty strong, which is the backdrop is Spain. There's this kind of giant high rise that had just been built. Jenny Agutter, from American Werewolf in London. She plays this architect who was married to another rich architect, and I guess he helped build this building with her, but he died in the process. And how he died under mysterious circumstances. And in the first like 10 minutes, Jenny is giving these very wealthy businessmen a tour of the building, and then on their way out, the window washer falls to his death. And we cut to Michael Moriarty, who's an American.
Like that happens in The Beyond.
Yeah, and we meet Michael Moriarty's detective character, who is an American in Spain, who's on vacation, but he's called into duty for some weird reason. I don't know how. And on their way to the building, he's like, how many deaths? And he's like, two. And he's like, two people fell. And he's like, well, no, the window washer and the guy he fell on. And it was one of the wealthy businessmen. I'm like, all right, we're off to a great start.
Yeah.
And then basically what you have is this yarn, the supernatural yarn about crazy supernatural things happening in this building, mysterious deaths, people dying in the elevator, people dying on, you know, just like through construction things. That was very eloquent. But
construction-y things.
For instance, you have like one guy who's in an elevator and you have a lot of shots of people in elevators going down and staring off mysteriously at things. And you never see what the reverse coverage is. And then they step off the elevator and then something happens to them. Mm. In one instance, one guy just steps off the elevator, grabs a gun, and starts shooting everybody in the lobby. And Michael Moriarty is on the case to try to figure out what's going on. And the outcome is not surprising, but boy, is it...
It takes its time to get there,
but I have a sneaking suspicion for my colleagues who absolutely and mysteriously love Poltergeist 3. Yeah.
Yes.
It might get you off.
Poltergeist 3 has gag after gag after
it
gag.
It is such a good
so does, And so does the finale of Dark Tower. Uh-huh. But right. Boy, oh okay. Boy, this movie is a stinker.
Is it Moriarty play piano in this or not? That's usually my barometer.
I love Michael Moriarty playing piano. Yeah. If he's not scatting, I don't know.
The funny thing is like both Michael and Jenny are doing their best. They really are doing their best to bring the best of the material. Like,
yeah, they're pros.
There's a moment where you could see like the door opens and it's Jenny's intro, and you could tell like she's just being very actory. She's like, I'm in the moment. I'm gonna go through the scene, and it's just like this nonsensical soap opera about what happened to her husband. Da, da, da. Oh God, it was a fucking chore to get through this movie.
Wow.
But if you guys are interested, I don't think it exists on Blu-ray. I think it's something you have to find on VHS. But confirmed, there are two movies out there called Dark Tower, and they both suck.
Okay. He has closed his laptop with that, guys. He is done.
I'm gonna go get Graham. I'll be right
back. Okay. I was like, and jerk out. He's dropped the mic on that one.
Bold statement. If you're looking for a good documentary on John Carpenter, do not watch The Carpenter. Because instead of John Carpenter, you get Wings Hauser as a ghost working on construction on your house.
So it's not even a dark.
It's just called The Carpenter.
I didn't understand where your joke was going.
No, it was good, but it got there. This is one that somebody recommended me because of my love of Wings Hauser, and it's kind of like you got the setup of kind of like a softcore late night movie, but instead of porn or sex, you get Wings Hauser, which is similar, and like the hair's cool. No, I actually really like Wings in this. He's good. He's always good, but it's really
weird. Cover is amazing, by the way.
Yeah, it's a really crazy cover. I posted an alternate cover to that, which is actually amazing. And if it was that movie, it's him in a white suit coming out of like smoke, and it looks amazing. But it just never has that scene. It fits under the House of Psychotic Woman. What is Keira's book?
House of Psychotic Women.
It fits into that kind of model because it's about a woman who, from frame one, is kind of being checked out of mental asylum, kind of let's scare Jessica to deathy. But the tone is never realistic or grounded, and I really hate the tone of this movie. And she's kind of, you know, she's out of it. Her husband's like this. Yeah, that cover.
That's a great image.
Yeah, the image on the other cover.
I want to see the cover.
Utterly amazing.
This is the white.
I mean, that's Wings Hauser in a white suit coming out of smoke.
But the actual cover.
Who doesn't want to watch that movie? But the actual cover is closer to what the movie is.
I remember that VHS now. Okay.
But it's cool because Wings is the ghost. So basically, there's a crew working on a house construction during the day.
Oh, okay. I know that one.
Yeah, that's the VHS cover that I remember. Cover.
And then at night, the crew go away and somebody's still working on the house after hours, and the woman comes down and goes like, oh, you're still working here, and it's Wings Hauser in construction clothes, and he's like, yeah, I'm just gonna finish up. But of course they all think it's a scab, a student coming at night, and so that's kind of the drama of the movie, which is quite bad.
Somebody's doing the drywall after hours.
Wings kind of starts to try to seduce her, and he is really fun, and he's always kind of fun, but he's just watching this movie going, no, this movie does not work as a horror film to me. It's just something about it. But let me follow straight on the heels of one that does.
Wait, there's one release that says The Carpenter. You'll be nailed to your seat.
You know this.
I just wasn't.
This really does sound like The Plumber, but where The Plumber really executes really well.
It's really good. I think again, the woman's mind is never there, so she's never established to be like actually sane. So all of this makes sense to be crazy. And the conclusion, like he's actually seducing her, and it's very quick how they conclude this movie. So I can't. It is on Amazon streaming though. That's how I saw it.
Yeah.
So it's free. Mm. You will not have to pay for this movie.
Are there multiple cuts? Do we need to have somebody watch all of them?
Longer cut.
We need a website that will direct us. But I did want to follow it up quickly because this one is super fun. I had seen a while back Ryan Rollins on his post say, oh, I love this movie. And I was like, I've never even heard of this movie. Fuck, it's awesome. And I think you're going to love it. Welcome to Spring Break, a.k.a. Nightmare Beach.
Oh, I need to see
Umberto
that.
Umberto Lindsay.
Is that on Amazon?
It's on Amazon. I think I had to pay for it.
I need to
But I think it was like $5 and you get to own it. An SD is one of those kind of ones.
Welcome to Spring Break.
It has Michael Parks, who is just drunk from start to end. You can tell he's just not in control. John Saxon, who's great in it. It's Umberto Lindsay started the film, and then at a certain point, he just kept producing it, and he hired a different guy to direct.
Bring it.
This movie is the number one movie
that
to pair.
That cover's awesome, right?
Yeah,
the cover.
Yeah. And there's another poster where I look up the Italian poster. It's just the guy's visor with a woman's screen
this
dying in it.
This is awesome.
Yeah, look at that, Rob. Yeah. That's so freaking good.
Wow. It's a tight cover.
Nightmare Beach is a better title.
Oh, yeah.
But the cool thing about this, I really love Italian films. You know, we always joke with pieces where you have a film shot in Italy where it pretends to be America. That's one thing. But I love when the Italians come to America. I love The Beyond because it's shot in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
This is shot in Florida, Spring Break, for real. This would make the best film to pair with Spring Breakers. Like, it would be such a fun double feature because they're both ridiculous. Like,
does she wear the headphones the whole time?
A lot of people do.
Because I'm kind of into that.
get ready, though. There's a gang of bikers in this movie. So keep in mind, this is made by an Italian. The gang of bikers is called... they're called Demons, and the patch is the same as the logo of the movie.
No.
Yes. It's the yellow font, the whole thing. I was like, oh my God, it's like a reference to Demons. Super cool. Okay, so it opens with a guy about to be basically a biker. He's about to be put to death at the electric chair by Michael Parks and John Saxon, who has framed him. So the guy gets put to death. He gets electrocuted in the opening scene, and then a mystery guy looks like the Wraith, you know, basically on a bike that has this little seat at the back of the bike, and he goes to people, he puts them on the back of the seat, and then he pushes a button and they get electrocuted from his bike.
Keep it going.
And this is happening.
I'm in.
This is happening during Spring Break in Florida. Then your central characters come in. This is where it gets a little goofier, right? Because up to this point, the central character is a guy who threw an interception pass for Florida State and lost the entire like pro whatever the Florida, you know, college football thing. So he's down on his luck. His friends gives him about 30 rubbers and says, you better have used all of these by the end of the week. And he's kind of depressed. And he doesn't want to use a rubber. He doesn't even want to have sex. He's kind of bummed, but he starts flirting with this beautiful girl who I think's from Inferno. She's definitely from an Argento. And they have a little thing going on. And basically it starts to become them trying to figure out, is this a ghost? That, you know, is this like the guy come back from the dead? Michael Parks seems to think it might be. He's drinking a lot. There's a crazy priest character trying to track it down. John Saxon's not exactly like this one. A few John Saxon kind of almost like a bad. He's a cop, but he's also kind of a corrupt cop.
Yep.
This is a really fun movie. Probably one of my like you know most fun kind of picks of lately. Even though it's not a great movie, but it's a really fun,
I gotta find
slasher.
This is Welcome to Spring Break, and your last two picks are from 1988.
Oh, weird.
Whereas Dark Tower is 89, so I see we're in a certain.
Well,
time.
I'm gonna jump in then with a 1988 movie.
Holy smokes!
Okay, I watched Remote Control.
Oh yeah, Lieberman.
Yeah, Jeff Lieberman. Yeah, yeah. So I had this is only available on VHS, to the best of my knowledge. And
he put out a
from his website. He has it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which he sold at Dead Ray Horror Trivia.
Okay, which I think is how I ended up with it. Because I have a DVD copy that I was like, I don't know how I got this, but
Rebecca
it doesn't look legit. I was apparently I was
tripping
there for
on
that.
The blue sunshine.
But I have a copy and I was like, I don't know how I got this, but I've never
I still haven't seen this one, weirdly enough. It's the only one of his.
It is so fun. It is definitely 1980s fun. It is literally about Kevin Dillon.
His hair.
Who in his hair, and he's working in a video store, and Jennifer Tilly is there, and one day they she sends out this, they can't find the copy of the movie that the person asked for, and so she's like, take this instead. And they send out this movie, and then they realize that this movie, which is kind of like a 1950s sci-fi flick, is actually brainwashing people and making them go on murderous rampages. So it's like Blue Sunshine without the acid in a videotape instead. And the videotape was created by aliens to take over the world. And so then the aliens are going to come after enough people go crazy and murder
each other. Is that a spoiler
or
not a spoiler?
No. Okay. You find all this out in like the first... This is the first act. I have only touched on the first act. It is nuts. And somehow it even, I wrote down, referencing Truffaut's Bastiers Volés. I'm going to say that name wrong. But somehow they're referencing like Truffaut films
talking about...
It's nuts.
Well, Lieberman is one of those guys who's really into like high-end cinema as well.
Yeah, I think you'd love it because it is a lot of fun, but my memory of it is that it's because anytime he tells his story, when Lieberman tells his stories of how these things inspired him, for him it was the idea of like being in New York City and going to the video store and basically like commenting on how, oh, there's all these people that are like zombies just like walking around trying to figure out what to do for the weekend, which is go home and watch something. And so video store culture is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
Like
cool.
The whole, a lot of it, especially the beginning, takes place at a video store. It's like, that's the basic like thrust of it. It's like, oh, it's about video store culture, sort of, before it leads into this other like more ambitious idea.
Well, I was going to give him so much more credit with what I was about to say than just video store and people walking like zombies. I was about to say, this feels like a high-end, like 1950s reflection on the Cold War, and seeing it in the 1980s light feels really topical for the time period. Apparently,
Ernie, can you
none of that is true.
Put her comment first, but then for Rob, and we'll then.
Well, I don't know. We'll if I'm
it
right.
No, no, and it definitely, because it is aliens and they're brainwashing people. It really does have this 1950s Cold War, but since it's in the 1980s, you kind of get that again. And so, I was thinking that he was kind of bringing back, you know, the whole like the outsiders, Mother Russia is coming to get us thing that we had going on in the 80s. I will now email Lieberman and just directly ask him.
That's right. Directors never know what their movies mean.
I was giving him a lot of credit on this one. You referenced Truffaut, so I figure it's a 50s Cold War reference.
Can I tell a funny Jeff Lieberman remote control story, which I hope he's not listening.
It's possible.
Because he does sometimes.
He does.
No, I really like Jeff a lot. He's been on our show. He was on Killer POV. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then obviously we did a really great event at Jump Cut Cafe, your cafe, when it was open for Blue Sunshine, which is on the Blue Sunshine.
Oh, we're on,
it's on the Blu-ray. On there.
I totally forgot we're on that whole Q&A.
And
thing.
So at that point, I'd known him pretty well. And, you know, he's got that kind of sarcastic New York humor. Yeah, cool. And I'm formerly from New York, so we kind of have that thing going. And so anyway, he was showing Remote Control at the New Beverly. It was it was a double bill with Lady Terminator. Mm. So it was like an amazing night.
Great screening.
Yeah, it was a great screening. And anyway, he was there for Remote Control, and he was selling copies of the Blu-ray and the disc. And I'm like, you know what? It's the only Jeff Lieberman movie I don't have. So I go up to him and I ask him, I was like, hey, I'd like to actually buy a Blu-ray. And he's like, for you, you got it. I'll just give it to you. And we had this kind of Larry David moment where he starts opening my DVD, my Blu-ray to sign it, and I just don't like people signing my stuff anymore. And so I'm kind of like, oh, do I stop him? Because like I kind of don't want him to sign it, but I'm so happy he's giving it to me, and I was willing to buy it if he wouldn't sign it. And so now I look at my collection and I think to myself, somebody wrote all over my remote control. I sense
just
it.
Somebody.
I see it.
I'll swap
it's there.
You, Rob, because I have it as well.
You have the Blu-ray.
I have
no, but it's too Rob G. Oh. I can't. It's terrible. It's not that bad, but I just thought it was hilarious that that's how I felt in the moment where he's like opening it up and trying to do this nice gesture for me. And I'm like, ah, oh, no, don't.
That's pretty funny.
Anyways, I love you, Jeff.
It's a fun film.
Anything else, anybody?
I got one more.
Yeah, I have one more too. Ciara came home. Ciara, if you listeners don't know, is my fiance. She's Filipino. She came home with Dalaw, which is a Filipino horror film. She told me she was going to get me on the Filipino horror kick. She showed one of her first dates was watching a few. So this one.
Has she shown you the pregnancy one yet?
No.
Okay, I got to figure out the name of this one. It's very specific. Right. You'd know it if you saw it.
Yeah, this one is very much, it feels like Blumhouse Filipino horror.
How are you even spelling that?
I'm looking at
Dalaw.
It's Dalaw. So naturally.
Dalaw.
So yeah, she was like, oh, honey, I brought home this. And I was like, Dalaw. And she's like, no, it's Dalaw. And I was like, all right, I'm still probably mispronunciating it.
So, okay, 2010. I got you. Okay.
Yeah. And 2010, dramatic supernatural horror film about a woman whose husband died. 3 years later, she remarries, but it turns out it's like kind of like that long lost love that she had when she was younger. But due to the insistence of her parents, she had to marry this other guy, and he died tragically. And so now that he's dead, she's like, well, I'm going to get back together with this guy. He's a little hunky. He's got a little bit of a history now. He's been around. So there's always this suspicion of, oh my God, is my husband cheating on me or not? And while this is kind of tooling around in the back of her brain, her home becomes haunted, and she's like, oh my God, it's my dead husband. He's really pissed that I remarried. What's going on? Luckily, she's got her mother-in-law there to kind of give her the lowdown on what might be going on supernaturally. She's got a neighbor next door who's got a wonky eye. She's got a white, pure white eye.
That's and the clinical definition.
Wonky eye.
Wonky eye.
And what she does, and she holds her hand over her good eye, and she could see the supernatural with her other eye.
Whoa.
And I was like, that's something I could chew on. I love that aspect. Yeah, and I was like sitting there going, how can we work this into an Insidious? Ooh. And I really, really love that.
Don't
aspect.
Admit that on
but,
here.
No. There's some really, really good stuff in there. And I mean, like, the acting's a little hokey, and I had to kind of, there's a lot of subtitling, which is fine. But you could still, you know, the acting was fine. And I thought the casting was a little mismatched. I guess the lead actress is really famous in the Philippines. But she didn't seem right for the guy for some reason. Like, I don't know. Just like he seemed like super handsome and fresh off like a jeans ad. And it was just like, what? What's going on?
Well, I got to tell you, on the IMDb page for Delah, normally they have photos from the film.
Like, oh, yes. What's
these,
on there?
These look like
publicity stills for the actors.
Like, it's very bizarre.
Yeah, check it out.
Like,
look at that.
Her with like this like handsome dude.
Yeah.
And then I guess that's the other dude.
That's a hunky. No, that's the main guy.
Oh, those are some hunky dudes. And a Denny's ad.
Yes, he looks like he's fresh out. I mean, like,
there you go. And there's like her in a room, kind of scared.
Yeah,
maybe.
Despondent at best.
But I will say, I mean, there's a handful of scares that do work. The main ghost creature thing that's in there is just like covered in mud, so you never really see what it is. You can't get a beat read on it. But it was effective, even if it felt a little soap operatic. But it was also equally fun to watch it with my fiance, who would scream out in Tagalog every once in a while, and I'm like, "What are you screaming?" She's like, "Get the fuck out of there." And I was like, "Oh, okay."
And this is on Prime, Amazon Prime.
It is on Amazon Prime.
Look at that.
Dalao.
Dalao.
Anyways, a very educational and fun experience. Oh, I'm looking at the IMDb page. It was released on Christmas Day in the Philippines.
Wow. That's a big release.
So I'm looking forward to seeing some more of these. Actually, Ciara did take me to one at the Burbank 8, which is the one inside the
where the
mall.
IKEA used to be? Or the, in the
no,
mall.
It's the one in the mall. And she took me to one, and I'm
they
just going to read off.
Bowling alley carpet.
I'm going to read. This is the one I saw in theatrically. It was called The One That Ghost Away.
Oh.
And if you want to know, it's like one of the Wayans Brothers send up of horror. So you actually have all of these kind of horror icons popping up through this kind of supernatural comedy. And they have like a riff on Samara.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's hilarious that when you first meet her, she's crawling out of the television, but she's so big she can't crawl. She can't pull herself out of the TV, and they have to help her.
Oh my God!
I was like, what?
That's
the
really
hell?
Funny.
Wow. There's some really funny stuff in there, but it's very Wayans-esque humor in a scary movie. But anyways, it's been fun going through that.
Okay, well, I'll do one more. So I have been watching the Picnic at Hanging Rock TV show that is now streaming on Amazon Prime. And this, I had read not very good reviews about it, but I have been absolutely loving it. I'm on episode 4 now, and I'm really excited to get home and keep watching it. This is based off the true story from 1900 about three girls and their kind of governess, I'll say. It was a representative of their school who go. In Australia, they go on this picnic. The girls decide to go hiking for a little bit, and they all vanish without a trace. And
it has some Aboriginal legend around the rocks
themselves. The rocks themselves are supposed to be really mystical. So it's the true story. And the TV show is based off the 1967 novel that was written about this. And then in 1975, Peter Weir made a movie. And this TV show is definitely hitting a lot different beats than the movie. It goes a lot more into the girls. It gets kind of even mean girlish, where it gets into like the girls' backstories and the cliques and who's with who and who's doing what and why the girls could have intention. It also gets a lot more into the town, the way that the school itself was viewed by the town, who the headmistress is and her backstory. And here's the cool part, and the reason that I am going to keep watching it. It is shot like fucking Stoker. It is the most beautiful thing I have seen and probably since Stoker, where even just the basic act of like watching one of the girls eat a slice of watermelon, I'm just like, oh my God, this is the most decadent cinema I have seen in years. Stars Natalie Dormer, who I love. I loved her on Game of Thrones. Yep. And then she was in The Forest, which has...
I mean, you loved her. Does that mean she's no longer on the show?
And on Game of Thrones? Wasn't that like five seasons ago? Here, people, catch
she
up.
Could still be around.
But I enjoyed her in The Forest, though the movie had its high and low points. I enjoy her as an actress. I'll say that. I didn't like The Forest
we
that much.
We resorted to barking on the show.
Barking. Woof. But that said, I like Natalie Dormer. She was great on Game of Thrones. And so I actually am really, really liking her in this. And the whole time I'm watching, I'm like, this is just a feast for the eyes. It's like painted. And then I got really interested in the directors. And one of the main directors was the main director on Hannibal, which explains a lot as well.
Do you think they're going to, because to get me to watch this, I was saying to you before, I need it to show me something that, because the movie doesn't speculate to what happened to them at all. Mm-mm. It's like they disappear and then it's you're dealing with the remnants of that for most of the movie, but it's somewhat sci-fi-ish, the music they put to it, but you don't see anything, which is in line with the mystery because no one really knows. But do you think they're going to posit an idea? Do you think they'll push
they're
that?
Positing, I'm only on episode four. So far, they're positing a lot. They are leaning hard on the mystery. Yeah. There is like a mystical element because even in the first episode, when you're out there and you're watching the girls at the picnic, they're slowing down time. They're speeding it up at varying points. Like they're really playing with it. And you can't tell if that's just part of like this really badass cinematography that suddenly everything's moving in slow motion for 30 seconds. But then one of the girls will move at regular speed and seems to be aware of what's going on. So there's definitely
one of them
things that they're playing with.
In the original and probably the story, I believe one of them returns.
I have not reached that point yet.
And she doesn't remember what happened. So that's the one of the, I mean, in the movie.
In the movie.
So, and I remember she's kind of like really attacked for like, what did you do? What are you? It's, I mean, the original movie is an amazing movie. It's not really a horror movie.
There
it's
is part of that because mystery. In this, four girls go out and then three vanish. So one is always there and has no memory of what went on. And so, that is kind of there
sex
from
cult.
The get-go. Sex cult.
But no,
but even just the different things that they set up and how they explored, it's just really fascinating so far. And it's short. It's only like, I want to say six episodes. It might be seven, but it's just, if you enjoyed watching Stoker or Hannibal, like it's worth it just to watch the portrait that they paint visually.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, we have a special guest, so we're going to take a break in a moment. Last thing I want to say, by the way, one of my acquisitions, Zombieology. Enjoy yourself tonight. Crazy Chinese movie. It's on Amazon Prime now. Please check it out. I think it's really fun and crazy. I know people keep asking me, but what if I have zombie fatigue? Yes, I understand, but this is bonkers Asian cinema at its finest, and I know that not a lot of you have seen it yet, so please watch it on Amazon Prime.
Zombieology.
Also, because now it feels free.
That documentary that I think you guys have both brought up before on the Hellraiser disc, part one of that great Hellraiser documentary is now on Shudder. And I just watched it last night, and that's remarkable.
What's the name of it again?
I did not write that part down. I wrote Hellraiser Documentary Part 1.
Okay.
I think it's Leviathan.
Leviathan, that's it. Yeah, that's correct.
It was excellent.
Yeah, it's really good.
I mean, no Clive, but everyone else is involved, and it's just fascinating.
Yeah.
I did want to just quickly, sorry to ruin your outro, because I know we're not going to get to talk about
it. It was a really good outro.
It was a really good outro. I like to undo most of Rob's good work. There's a crazy movie called Horsehead. I was curious. The reason I wanted to bring it, I wanted to know if anyone had seen it.
Yeah.
Looking at Graham. No.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There's that,
I saw the fantastic.
Yeah. There's thing. That. There's a releasing company called Artsploitation. It should tick all my boxes, but it does not. But it is interesting. Catriona McCauley from all of the great Fulci, basically the trilogy of Fulci films and Inferno. She plays the mom, so it's really cool to see her. And it's basically an ode to Fulci and Argento. Like it's, and to the point where it's too much an ode to them and a lot of fast cutting and those kind of movies. Whenever I see people cut too much in a movie where you're meant to be drawn into like the mysterious, I'm always like, guys, long takes pull you in. All these edits are just kind of, you have to save for when it's
never
necessary.
Never even heard of this.
No, and the only reason, there's a couple different people have recommended, Chris from Horror Trivia, and Chris, producer Chris, he had said there's a couple shots that something I'd written that reminded him him. He said, and I totally know what he's talking about. It's got some really interesting imagery, really interesting moments. Basically, a young girl comes home to a really strange family relation dynamic with her mom, and then starts finding out the mother had this really intense, bad relationship with the father, who may or may not still be some sort of specter. Honestly, it's one of those movies where I could not recount the plot of this movie because it's so confused.
Fever dream,
yeah, for sure. But one thing that is interesting about it is, if anyone's, because I know a lot of people try to write these kind of scripts, it's about lucid dreaming. It's not just using lucid dreaming, but it's a girl who's learned how to do lucid dreaming from books so she can go into these dreams and position herself to have more power. So it's really, I think if you're really into art, horror, cinema, you might find this interesting.
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime as well.
Yeah, I just watched it last night, and I mostly wanted to bring up because I want to know if anyone here had seen it, because I didn't. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like we've talked about it before. But
I think Sam Zimmerman and I saw it at Fantastic Fest many years ago. I mean, Romain Bassett's got a really great eye.
Yeah,
visually. But narratively speaking, it's not my cup
of tea. It's the not as good version of like Dark Water.
Yeah.
It's a similar kind of things where they're doing this art piece horror, but Dark Water works better as a movie.
Was Sam into it?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, because that sounds
I'm
like
shocked
a Sam
it's not
Zimmerman.
On Shudder. It felt sure, like a Shudder thing sure. that would be on Shudder. Sure. It's not quite as bonkers as a Graham Skipper film, but it's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Graham Skipper. Not as good of an outro as Rob did, but we'll take it. Graham Skipper.
I was trying my best.
Horsehead bookends.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the new action film Revenge, now available in theaters and on demand. Jen is enjoying a romantic getaway with her wealthy boyfriend, which is suddenly disrupted when his sleazy friends arrive for an unannounced hunting trip. Tension mounts in the house until the situation abruptly and viciously intensifies, culminating in a shocking act that leaves Jen left for dead. Unfortunately for her assailants, Jen survives and reemerges with a relentless, wrathful intent. Revenge. Declared a beautiful, brutal revelation and awarded a perfect 10 out of 10 by Screen Crush, Revenge is a razor-sharp feminist subversion of the revenge thriller and a must-see film. It is in theaters and on demand now.
Tonight's episode is also brought to you by the Horror Movie Night podcast. Every week, brothers Matt and Brian and their best friend Scott watch a different questionable horror film. Ranging from forgotten low-budget films like The Uninvited or Invisible Maniac, cult classics like Sleepwalkers, or beloved films like The Gate and Halloween 3, Horror Movie Night has definitely discussed one of your favorite horror movies. Whether they are hypothesizing about the coke-fueled writing session for the brain or lamenting about how as adults they will never be as cool as Rudy and Monster Squad, they lovingly dissect horror movies with the precision of Dr. Giggles. Listen for yourself at hmnpodcast.com. Additionally, this month, on June 23rd, the podcast will celebrate its 150th episode. To do so, they will be hosting a 12-hour horror movie Twitch stream marathon to raise money for Planned Parenthood. The trio will watch and commentate over 8 of their favorite films starting at noon Eastern, live at twitch.tv/geekscapetv. So please check out the Horror Movie Night podcast.
The Shockwaves team is thrilled to be involved in the Stephanie Rothman Fellowship for Female Film Students. The fund focuses on film students who identify as female and who want to make horror, science fiction, action, and fantasy, and thriller movies. The fund is presented by the Shockwaves podcast and Etheria Film Night and was created by Shockwaves' very own Rebecca McKendry, who I can see right now. Our goal is to give away $5,000 to a female film student each year. We're in the final push of a fundraising goal and need to raise about $1,500 more. Please help us, Shockers! We are posting the donation link on our Facebook and Twitter, and we'll also post it on the Shockwaves Fan Club Facebook page. Every little bit helps. Even if you can only send $5, that will help us reach our goal to support diverse voices in the horror industry. If you send $1,500, this will be a lot quicker. Please find us on socials for the donation link, and we thank you so much for helping us support women in genre films.
The Shockwaves crew is super excited to announce that we are heading to the Mad Monster Party Convention in Phoenix this July. This amazing convention runs from July 13th to the 15th at the WecoPa Resort, just outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale, Arizona. Mad Monster has some amazing guests lined up like Robert Englund, Kane Hodder, Lance Henriksen, plus a ton of guests from the entire Elm Street franchise. And the Shockwaves team, minus myself, Mr. Ryan Turek, will be there doing a live show. Check out madmonster.com for more info, and we can't wait to see you in Arizona. And while you're there, touch Ulrich's face.
Just touch it. Just touch it.
You're going down, Turek.
Okay, welcome back to the show. And we were just reminiscing about the last time we had this guy on a show because it was very questionable. It was Shockwaves. It was Shockwaves episode 10.
Wow.
Right? It was in Early my days. Apartment when yeah. I was patching the show together manually because Becca wasn't there. And I'm looking at a drunken photo of me, Elric.
Someone's face is in someone's
It's Joe Bigos' face in Elric's crotch.
Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh.
Where it's questionable crotch.
And it's a sandwich. In the middle of it is Graham Skipper.
The old Graham Skipper.
Yeah. And he's back. And he's holy back. Smokes.
No,
I'm
were
glad.
You on Killer POV as well?
I was.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The musical,
Oh, the musical episode. That was such a great episode. Yeah. Can we do that one again?
Sure.
Yeah, let's do it. Graham and I are going to go do musicals.
We're going to leave. You guys do your musical episode.
I do a whole musical podcast.
Done.
I knew Graham before he had seen First Blood. I mean, how crazy is that that any human, grown adult man, hadn't seen First Blood, but Graham was one, and it changed your life.
It did change my life. It's like one of my top probably 20 movies of all time.
I love that when you saw that and how excited you were.
I like to think that because because of First Blood, he decided, you know what? I'm going to give this directing thing a shot.
Yeah.
And
that's what it was.
That's where the song.
So somehow it all happened because of Elric?
No, it wasn't me.
Oh,
then.
Okay.
You watched
you
that
just
on
were
set.
There. No,
let's not give him that much credit.
I watched that for Joe.
Yeah,
we're almost human.
Because the opening is
the opening is of Mind's Eye is First Blood.
First Blood.
He was like, oh yeah, you should just rewatch First Blood. I go, I don't think I've ever seen it. He was like, what the fuck?
That's actually a pretty good impersonation. Yeah, how he would sound in that
pretty much. But it's great.
All right. Well,
you got a movie out.
I do.
Currently on Shudder.
Yes.
Sequence Break.
Sequence Break is out on Shudder
after a nice little festival run.
Yeah, it's been amazing.
From Herbert West. A big time director,
big time guys.
That should have been the intro.
Thanks for the people fanning me with palm fronds as I walked in.
Wonderful grapes up the hallway. Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Have you been reading the feedback on the Shudder boards?
I have. It's been awesome, and like the reception has been like overwhelmingly positive. I made a. It's funny. I was thinking back to we premiered at the Chattanooga Film Fest last year, and I remembered something that Christopher Cargill said to me as he walked up to me after seeing the movie. He was at the premiere, and he said, "Look, so I'm going to tell you something. You made an awesome movie. You also made a fucking weird movie, and so you're going to get some people that will hate your movie because it's fucking weird. But remember, it's awesome."
Yeah.
I was like, "Great!" And so I was really like, I sort of steeled myself for some of the negative reaction. And we've had some of that, but after the Shudder release, like, man, everyone on Twitter, like everything I've seen, has just been overwhelmingly positive, and they get it, you know. And
that's the difference with Shudder and Netflix is like Shudder is the built-in audience for movies like
Shudder.
This.
Mm-hmm. You're literally catering it to exactly the type of people that would want to see this film.
Oh, yeah,
that's the beauty of Shudder.
Yeah, it's been great, and people are at Q&As and stuff. People have always really asked really smart questions and have really, been willing to kind of go. I mean, it's a weird, heady, surreal movie, and people have been willing to. Sort of go the distance with it. So I've been very grateful for that and just and happy now that it's out in the world.
I love the DIY quality of the film. Yeah. I mean, like, it's just like you got in there, you got under the hood, you did, the film speaks louder with its ideas and weirdness than anything. And that's what I love about it.
Thanks. Yeah, we tried to, just really go for it. I mean, we when we set out to make this movie, we were like, this is a bigger movie than, than – Now, what am I trying to say? We were like, this is a big movie with big ideas, and it's going to go to some really bizarre places. Mm. And so the rule just needs to be, because we're going to have to make this thing fast. And so we're going to be faced with some hard choices. And the rule always has to be make the bolder choice.
Mm-hmm.
When given two options, what's the bolder choice? Do I go with this light green, gel, or do I go with this Argento green gel? Mm. Well, you go with the Argento green gel. And that was really the guiding principle for the whole movie, was just to always make the boldest choice possible. And I think fortunately it paid off.
Yeah.
And you start these kind of movies, like, I feel like this kind of low budget, like, I'm just guesstimating, but those kind of under a couple $100,000 features, the most important thing is the actors. And I think, like, Chase, the girl I'd recognized from another recent film, was it the Cocktail, Teenage Cocktail?
Yeah, Fabi's in Teenage Cocktail, Southbound, Starry Eyes.
She's really good.
Yeah.
She's also in John Dies at the End with Chase.
But Chase is really good in this, and this is a different, like, what I love about Chase is when he usually plays, like, something light and kind of funny and, like, breezy, he's such a natural at playing that role that I really like that this was not that, and he really carries the weight of the whole movie as, like, a guy who's actually fairly angst-ridden and suffering a little bit and really wants, you know, A, he's losing his job, B, starts getting sucked in, and you see this a totally different, I don't think I've ever seen him play a character at all like this, to be honest.
But it still felt like Chase because it was still the same, I've always said that I could make an entire movie out of Chase's facial reactions.
Totally.
And the same thing applied here where it was still like you could read everything that was going on just on Chase's face.
I agree. I think you know, part of the reason I wanted to work with Chase was because he's just so natural. I mean, everything, he can be in the most bizarre sort of situation and you immediately buy that he's in it, you know. And so he was great to work with, especially, I mean, I put him through the ringer with some of the crazy shit I had to have him do, and he was able to completely drop it in and be, you know, I mean, he's having sex with an arcade machine, you know. it's like that's hard to put in your sort of magic if Stanislavski thing.
Well, I was gonna ask how this even all came about, because technically this isn't your first film that you've directed, if we want to get technical.
Sure.
How so?
Do go on.
So
there is a film before this.
There's a film before this. So I made, this was a long time ago. This is right after we had filmed Almost Human. Me and some friends of mine decided we were going to try to see if we could just make something in my backyard for like literally $0. So we made a little movie called Space Clown. It's really dumb.
Bonus feature.
Right.
Throw it in there.
You know, I made that, and that was really just sort of a fun kind of experiment to see what would happen. I'm very, you know, it took a long time to finish it, but it just was a good learning experience. But yeah, Sequence Break came about because I didn't really have like much of a drive necessarily to direct. Like, I wasn't too precious about it. I love writing, and I've always written a lot, and so I had an ambition to get scripts produced, but I was totally fine with, you know, other directors doing it. And then at some point while we were on the Mind's Eye tour, I was having in my personal life, I was sort of finding myself with this struggle of going like, oh gosh, I'm having to sacrifice, you know, my family life that I'm trying to build with my wife by being gone all the time to like make movies and to go tour with movies, and, you know, sort of feeling caught between like these two passions and having this fear of, oh gosh, do you have to only have one or the other? How do you make this work? And so I started just kind of working it out in a script, and because that was kind of the only way that I could figure out how to do that. And then I was reminded of an urban legend that I had read like 15 years ago about a killer video game called Polybius.
Oh yeah.
And you know, it's online, and in fact, I think Shudder Today posted like an article about it. And the short version is that there was an arcade machine somewhere in the 80s that supposedly people would play it and they would get hallucinations or seizures or die.
Cool.
And maybe mind control, maybe, you know, Men in Black or whatever. And so I had always thought that was a cool idea for a movie. And over the years, I had tried writing different like treatments for it, but nothing clicked. It was like, you know, a slasher movie, but with a video game. It was just kind of lame. And then I was working on this other concept, and I was sort of revisiting the works of Cronenberg. And then I went, gosh, this would be a really great convergence of things to tell this story through a body horror lens. Mm-hmm. And then I had a dream about a Technicolor melting skull, and I wrote the script. And that's really, you know, how it came about. And I, you know, it was my birthday, and I was at a German beer hall in Pasadena, and my godparents were there. Their names are Lyle and Audrey, and they, you know, Lyle was like my dad's roommate in college, and they're both actors out here in LA, and they've produced a bunch of theater, and they were there at my birthday, and they just sort of offhandedly said, like, hey, we're thinking of wanting to produce a film. Do you have any scripts? And I had this script that, you know, I just felt really strongly about, and it just felt really personal. And so I gave it to them, and they loved it. And for the first time, I went, you know, I feel like I know how to make this movie. I feel like this is personal to me. I need to make this movie. And then they put the money together, and we made a movie. Mm. Like, literally 6 weeks later, we were shooting. Wow. You know, and so it was really, it was amazing. It was just this perfect, like, bit of luck and just like Lyle and Audrey being these like amazing angels just sort of sent from heaven to say, you want to make a movie? And that never happens, but that's
what's,
what it was.
What's their email address for everyone? Because we got to make a clear path for the indie filmmaker out there. There's a sequence, speaking of the brokenest of sequences in this movie, it's like of that year. I started at the Knoxville Horror Film Festival last year. There's a sequence in the middle towards the end of your movie, I think, where you're talking about with the skull, which is like truly incredible, especially in an indie film. Like most of it is, you know, young people talking, conversations. That's what you know, usually have with an indie film. But there is a sequence where you have everything. I mean, you have stop motion. You have, I don't know, even know what else, but it really stuck with me. Like, I was thinking about it for days, that one sequence right in the heart of the film.
Yeah.
Walk us through a bit of that, even because people are probably going to watch the film and then, you know, hear this.
Yeah. Well, if you haven't seen the film, go watch it and come back. So the sequence you're talking about, you know, sort of the, you know, I call it like level three, you know, where he's really going in and he's you know, going off to save the girl. And yeah, you know, I've always been a really big fan of 2001, and at a certain point, I think I was watching I think it was at the when it was at the ArcLight last, or you know, a few years ago, and I was watching it, and I was just trying to really think about like why that end sequence has such power to it, and I was thinking about it, going, you know, here's a movie that is so like it builds you up to a certain place where you know, like, okay, this is pretty wild stuff, but then it slingshots you into something completely different. That goes like light years, literally, beyond where the rest of the movie is. And I went, how can I try to achieve that with what's going on here? And so, you know, it was a matter of trying of, you know, the special effects design with Josh and Sierra.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, their stuff's great.
You know, of really, you know, saying like, how do we take what we've already seen and then make it something like so far beyond what it had been? You know, taking a lot of inspiration from like Evil Dead with the stop motion, like reverse animation stuff. Mm-hmm. The melting skull was something from the very beginning that I wanted in there because I just thought this is something that you're not going to see in an indie film, and this is something that's going to be a really powerful, strong image.
Did you have to consult with an animator of any kind, or just
I mean, not really. You know, obviously we worked with Jason Miller and Neil Jonas, who helped develop all the stuff for the video game, that animation, which is sort of its own thing. But as far as the stop motion stuff, no. I mean, it was really like the skull. We literally just, you know, Josh and Sierra built it, and the only direction I gave them, I said I want it to be anatomically correct for Chase, but don't put any blood in it, because I want it to just be. I don't want it to be like a gruesome thing. I want it to be a surreal thing. And so then they built it, and we hung it upside down and put a bunch of heat guns on it and set the camera to roll and walked away.
Yeah.
You know? And like, and it looks awesome.
Yeah.
And so it was really, it was just about that. It was about, you know, sort of troubleshooting how do we, you know, how do we make a black void? That's a lot harder than you might think, you know? So we looked at set photos of Under the Skin.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And you figure it out and you make it happen. And so that was, it was really exciting and a big adventure and just a matter of everybody being on the same page with like going, okay, we're going to make something bonkers. How do we achieve this?
Yeah. I mean, like you're a fixture on the film festival circuit from all the films that you star in. So the first time you take this to a film festival, you know, are you sweating bullets? Or are you just like, you know what? These are my
it's
people.
Awful. It's awful. No, I mean, it's great, but it's so much more nerve wracking than being there as an actor. Because as an actor, you know, you go there.
Point to the finger to the director.
Exactly.
Like, it's his fault.
My performance was great. Yeah, it's just, it's so, you know, as an actor, you're there for like 4 or 6 weeks and then you're done. And then the movie kind of magically appears and you're able to sort of reap all the benefits, you know? And as a director, like you slave on this thing for, you know, a year and a half, 2 years, and it's every single day. And then here you are, and you are the guy holding the DCP that you crossing your fingers works right, you know, and you're the guy that's, you know, that is totally to blame if there's anything that people don't like in the movie. And, you know, it's your baby. You want it to do well. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's totally nerve-wracking, but it's also that much more rewarding, you know?
Yeah. Well, your film comes in a line of horror films throughout history that bring a video game element into a horror story.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think there's enough here that warrants a discussion. He's taking
I think the first question has to be, did you screen any of them?
Hang on, wait a second. Well, before we do that, I'm looking at Becca's notes.
Well, I crossed out some because I started with...
Because you picked video game adaptations.
Adaptations. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to go back and redo it.
Yes.
So, yes. Yeah.
Video. But, these are horror films with a video game.
So I have crossed out Rampage, which I still want to talk about.
And he did. And he had, previously, he had starred in a film about a game, but a board game, VHS game, of course.
Yes. Yes.
So I feel like there is some continuity to our conversation.
Sure. Would you say this is a sister piece to your sequence break?
Diamond Beyond the Gates.
Not really. You know, it came about,
there's some similarities.
Oh, sure.
I actually think
they're both two totally different.
Yeah, they're very different.
Thank you. Becca, to your point though about video game movies that are not movies with video games in them, there is one movie that has. I don't even know if it talks about it being a video game, but it does have footage of the video game upon which the movie is based.
Wait,
Doom?
No. House of the Dead.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So, right? Remember that, Jim?
I went to a costume party dressed as Liberty from that movie once, and no one knew who the fuck I was, but I owned the outfit already, so I was like, I'm doing it, and no one knew.
Is that you, Ball?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good for him.
Becca, how was that received?
Oh my God, awful, awful.
Did you have to go around
the costume?
Oh,
nobody knew who I was. Nobody had even seen the movie. And I was like, because at the time, House of the Dead Part 2, like the video game, was like the craziest thing ever.
Right.
And so I was like, well, I already own the jumpsuit because I'd worn it. This is in college. I'd worn something that looked almost identical in a dance recital I was in. And so I'm like, I'm just going to wear the jumpsuit and say I'm Liberty from House of the Dead. No one fucking knew who I was all night long. I was just girl in flag jumpsuit.
So good.
It was awesome.
I just want to say we blame Ubol for that movie and not any of the credited
writers. Not any of the credited writers who we love dearly.
Nice.
Uwe Boll, who has done other kind of video game adaptation movies, Post Alone in the Dark, that also needed some work.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, I'm curious, did you screen any for cast and crew? Was there anything in that
vein? The only screenings that we did, I sat down with Chase and Brian Sowell, my DP, and we watched Videodrome together.
Yeah.
And then I asked Fabi and Chase to watch The Fly. Because I think that love story between Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis is like one of the greatest cinematic love stories of all time.
It's so quick. Like they managed to make you really care fast.
That's exactly why I wanted them to watch it, is because these people meet and then like instantly they're soulmates.
Cheeseburger.
And that's all in one word, baby.
That's how they did it.
And that's something that, that happens in Sequence Break. And I was like, this is how I think this dynamic needs to be. So, but I think those were the only two. Huh. I mean, I watched a lot.
Not Ecstasy?
No.
That's where you have some of the most similarities.
And what's funny about that is when I started developing this, I had not seen Existence.
Oh, are you serious?
I hadn't seen it. And at some point throughout the process, somebody was like, oh, you should watch this. And I watched it, and we were already really far in the process. And I went, oh, wow. This movie is pretty close. But
not an arcade game.
Yes.
It's not an arcade game. But I love the movie. I think it's a lot better than people give it credit for.
I haven't seen it since it first came out.
You know,
I got to rewatch it. So.
I show, when I teach horror history, I always show Videodrome and Existenz back to back, and my students like Existenz far more.
I mean, I can see it. It's faster paced, you know?
Yeah.
It's more interesting.
And I'm sure that for contemporary audiences, the idea of, you know, identity through videotapes is not quite as much there as video gaming.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. What's on your list? What do you got on there?
What do I have?
I'm curious.
I'll start with a movie I watched today because this movie keeps popping up on.
Please. I hope it's the top of my list. I have a feeling it will be.
Possibly. I had never seen this, but everybody keeps telling me to watch. Kept like saying, "Oh, have you seen this? Have you seen this?" Arcade from Full Moon Features.
Oh, I actually like Arcade.
It's not bad.
It's not bad. There are genuine stakes in that movie.
There are genuine stakes. Yes. It's like
how you gauge good film. There are stakes.
Because you go in and you're like, oh, this is going to be garbage. And then you're like, oh, no, there's character stakes here.
I found myself at the end going, gosh, I'm really invested.
Is this horror? Because a lot of these are not like joysticks and stuff. Are like comedies. I was curious. Is Arcade a horror movie?
This is horror. This is horror. Yeah, basically the plot of
directed
it is
directed by
that
Albert Pyun.
Yeah, oh, wow,
Him. Yeah.
Yeah. The basic plot is that there's a virtual reality game called Arcade, and it's at an arcade called Dante's Inferno. And when you go into it, if you like get killed in the game, there's this creature called a Screamer that, you know, flies in, and it's like a big silver, you know, CGI dragon, and it and if it kills you in the game, then the game takes your soul, and then you're like brain dead in the real world. And so ultimately it you know, culminates and, you know, the girl has to go in to try to save everybody. But first of all, if you think that Lawnmower Man has bad, you know, computer graphics, just
which none of us do.
None of us think it looks awesome.
Arcade.
Written by David S. Goyer.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Did you know?
Interesting.
I did not.
Interesting.
And that's why it's got a little bit something smart something special.
Yeah, there's some man, at the end, do you remember, Ryan, the end of the movie when she encounters her mom?
Oh my God, yeah.
There's a moment at the end of this movie. I'm just going to spoiler alert. Yeah, I'm going to tell you. There's a moment so the girl goes into the game and she gets, like, you know, killed by the big final boss, and she dies in the game. And so we see her wake up, and she's in her bedroom at home, and she, like, goes downstairs, and her mom, who has been dead for the whole movie, which is like a major source of this girl's, like, anguish, is her dead mother. Her mom's alive, and her mom's like, "Oh, did you have a nightmare? Are you okay?" And she was like, "Oh, I had this horrible nightmare. I dreamed that you were dead." And her mom says, "I am dead, honey." And she goes, "What?" And then her mom pulls a pistol out and shoots herself in the head.
Yeah, what?
Yeah. And she's crazy, like screaming and crying. And then the mom wakes up and says, "See, I told you there was a heaven. I'm going to kill you now so you'll be with me forever." Then she puts the gun to her daughter's head and pulls the trigger.
And that's not how it works.
Yeah, it's not how it works. But I was going, shit, this is intense. The other funny thing of note in this movie is that the way that the like boss, like the evil game talks, he ends every single line when he's talking to the girl with, you know, it'd be like, "You can't win the game, bitch." Everything. Yeah, it's a good movie. It's a nice little
I haven't seen it in a while.
Yeah, it's like a 14-year-old. Something.
Megan Ward.
Yeah. Megan Ward from Freaked.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's where she's from.
Yeah.
I got to know if you've seen, because the one thing your film does not have is a track by Primus on the soundtrack, which is very disappointing to me, because when I think video game, if I can only mention one of these, it's Brain Scan.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Because I loved Brain Scan when I first saw it. And I didn't understand that it wasn't a big hit. It was one of those movies where I saw it on video at a certain age where I was like, yeah, this is going to be huge.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, because it's so fun. It's Edward Furlong. It's by the director. What I didn't know at the time is the director of Rolling Thunder, which is shocking, because he's such a legit director to make.
And
this,
wasn't it the writer?
Andrew Kevin Walker.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. Okay.
Seven.
Yeah. Seven. Yeah.
There was an argument on Twitter a couple of weeks ago between Brain Scan and the one that the Matrix is based off of.
The
movie that Matrix was very similar to, and I can't remember the name of it now.
Arcade.
Similar, I'll say.
Yeah, yeah. There's two Brain Scans, one with Vulcan as well.
People were loving Brain Scan.
Brain Scan is so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, so I'm a little nervous, but also the actor who plays the trickster.
Mm-hmm.
He's really interesting. And I looked him up, and he's not in many things, which is hard to believe. But Frank Langella's in it. It's got a lot of talent.
There's a lot of grim shit in it.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, like, speaking to the kind of dead mom angle of Arcade, I remember Brain Scan's got some pretty heavy teen angst, themes of loss, if I recall.
Right, and they're pulling in. It's a game he plays that he's slowly being pulled in to be framed for murders. Yeah. That part I remember. What is the game itself, though? I don't recall.
It's like a CD-ROM.
CD-ROM thing. But the idea is that you go into it and you're in a first-person perspective and you're doing all this stuff where you're having to kill... Or you're having to kill a person, or you're having to kill like a monster or something.
Yeah,
and then he like wakes up and he's really done it.
You've done it.
Yeah.
Oh, the trickster.
But the trickster's. I like the trickster.
Awesome, yeah.
He's like a JV Freddy Krueger.
I remember that one having some really cool effects too, like body morphing.
At the time, it did. I think.
Yeah.
It's one. I don't know why people don't talk about it. Is there a Blu-ray of it?
Yes. Well, Scream Factory is putting it out in August.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Just been announced for Blu-ray.
We are timely.
Another. Rob and I talked about this a couple episodes back, but Lawnmower Man has always held a special place in my heart.
And revisiting, I understand that Stephen King hates it because it's nothing like his story. Yeah. I think it's better than his story, quite frankly. I liked
his
revisiting
story,
it.
There isn't much.
Yeah. And I think, did we I'll have to go back. I think I watched the longer director's cut.
You watched the director's cut, and
which I thought was really cool.
Theatrical cut.
Yeah. No, I like Lawnmower Man.
The director's cut's got some layers to it.
Yeah. Well, the director's cut has that great extended sequence with the monkey, too, at the beginning. Which I like a lot, and I think like establishes a lot of that.
Yeah.
That like
the
relationship.
Monkey running around
VR. That's a bit of a. Because that's not really video games, but it's got that element to it. I guess the whole VR thing.
Oh, yeah. Reality. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because he's using games to enhance Job's.
That's right.
Oh, Job.
I'm throwing out a deep cut that only Graham's going to get.
I think
because
I probably
it's
have it on
Star Trek.
List. Uh-huh.
Okay. The next gen episode where Riker's banging the girl.
You mean the game?
Yes. And the game. And oh my gosh, I love that episode.
Wow. Which one is this?
It's like the Shell and Romy's high story.
Trekkies come
the game.
There is a next generation episode where Riker is having sex with
Google
some girl.
Riker banging babe.
Right
in
after.
The holodeck or not?
No, this is in real life. I think they're on vacation. Are they on
I think they're on Ryza.
They're on Ryza, which is like the vacation, the pleasure
planet.
It's the
planet.
Sex planet.
It's the sex planet. Nice. And so they're on Ryza, so he's having sex like you do on Ryza. Mm-hmm. And then this girl who he happens to be banging says, "Hey, I want you to try this thing." And she literally hands him like this like earpiece thing that kind of wraps around
like
to his eye.
It looks like a Google Glass.
Elric and I are literally watching this clip in real time as he explains.
So you guys keep talking about watching.
So and she's like, "You got to play this game. It's this awesome game. And literally all you do is like put a ball in a hole." And it's the most basic game, like these like little loopy kind of weird, almost Dr. Seuss looking holes form, and then you put a ball in it. And then you keep trying to advance.
But you're doing it with your mind.
And like, you're doing it with your mind. And he starts giving it to other people on the ship, and everyone becomes addicted
to
it.
Lasers to the eyes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and everybody gets totally addicted.
And I think doesn't Wesley have to stop
this.
Everybody?
Data, because Data always has to step in.
It was
one of the Data, your mind doesn't work like ours, step in episode.
I remember this.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I remember this.
It's a great episode.
Now, CGI is so bad.
Now, this is something that I think you'll flip out over. I can't remember what the system is, but it's one of those augmented reality things that they have now.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, someone has developed this game
oh my God.
For this augmented
My people!
Yeah.
It looks so basic.
I must play!
Yeah.
Had you seen, because the most obvious, like, just physically of your movie, the one that obviously jumps out probably is The Nightmares. What's that story?
The Bishop of Battle.
The Bishop of Battle.
Just
yeah.
in terms Nightmares. Of a kid, like, battling a game, and the myth you were just telling me about reminds me of that.
Again, too. Completely honestly, I had not seen before I made the movie. And then I think it was actually at Chattanooga, somebody was like, "Oh, have you seen Bishop of Battle?" And I was like, "No, what's that?" Yeah.
Well, Nightmares was never easy to find until recently.
It was made for TV movie.
I don't think I'd even heard of Nightmares.
I've watched it since, and I mean, it's a great segment.
Fun, yeah.
You know, it's fun. I there's one that I had to mention there's an Are You Afraid of the Dark episode that is called Pinball Wizard. Do you remember this one?
I do. It's wonderful.
It's the same plot as basically all of these movies where a kid, you know, is playing a pinball machine and gets sucked into the game and is trying to like save the girl, and then he saves her, but now he's trapped and he has to be in this pinball game forever, and a giant pinball, you know, is now rolling towards him, and that's the end of the episode.
How nice.
Well, I have one that I wish – it had so much potential, and I really liked the concept of it, but it just couldn't bear the weight of its concept, which is Stay Alive.
Oh, with Bathory.
With Bathory.
She was the villain in it.
And because video games had become so sophisticated by, you know, 2006, I think it's come out, you know, you had Resident Evil, you had all these like survival horror games, and this I think was one of the first video game movies to come along to embrace the survival horror movie, you know, survival horror game experience. And in this one, you're playing and it's like an Elizabeth Bathory type game.
She's trying to kill you with an axe.
Yeah, but she comes out of the game and then she winds up screwing with your reality and killing you off. But in the first 20 minutes, the problem is they establish all of these gamers, and they are the worst archetypes you can ever meet on the street. I mean, like, it's, you know, you've got these headphone wearing, you know, controller equipped idiots who are just like, bro, I got my game. You know, they're like talking all this technical lingo, and you're like, shut the fuck up. Nobody cares about it. Like, it's just like, look how hardcore gamer we are. And so you have to get through all of that, and then you have to sift through really shoddy effects.
Really bad CG. Really bad CG. Even she, like, I mean, this was like 2006, 2007. Yeah. She looked like shit.
It was
terrible. She was like really pixelated. Like they were trying to make her look like a video game, but like it's 2006 and she barely made it to like NES grade.
It's definitely the low end of the video game thing. I was looking for a relief from the torture porn stuff, mm-hmm. the mean-spirited torture porn stuff that was coming out at the time. There was a lot of remakes. There was a lot of torture porn. And I was like, oh, cool, a movie about a killer video game. I'm totally in.
Let's hope William Brent Bell isn't a listener. Deep cut director dive.
William Brent Bell, who directed The Boy, knows that he won me over with that. So
okay.
I thought that was fantastic.
There were we talked about it much earlier this year. We actually had two of the showrunner and the producer on for Dimension 404.
Oh yeah,
The show on Hulu, and there are two really tight episodes on that were specifically about video gaming. One is actually they do a version of Polybius, which is really cool. But then I loved the one called Impulse about the girl who is like a career gamer, and you drink something and it makes you go into like a bullet time where you can play like crazy. But then when you come to, it's like years in the future. I really enjoyed that one.
Is that series still going, or was it a one-off series?
I think they did like maybe how many episodes, 6-7 episodes as part of this, and I hope it gets re-upped. I enjoyed it.
No one's
mentioned the obvious film directed by the guy who starred in Halloween.
What?
Nick Castle.
Oh, Last Starfighter?
Last Starfighter?
Oh, yeah.
Were you in Last Starfighter?
Not horror, but awesome.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
What? There's monsters and creatures.
Oh, Elric, we just went through a list before the show.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about Tron.
I would talk
here,
about
Kane.
Joysticks here if it was up to me. But were you a Last Starfighter kid, or was I saying, okay? Because
yeah,
I think
that movie,
I haven't seen it for so long, but I feel like some people saw that at the right age, and that was the movie. Yeah.
I'd actually never seen it until the New Beverly did a Sunday matinee like a couple months ago.
Oh, wow. How did it feel now? I can't even imagine.
It was kind of, I mean, obviously it's of its time, but because I was watching it at a magical theater with a bunch of kids who were seeing it for the first time as well, it still won me over.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, all right.
Well, and also the actor, because he looks so young and like kind of handsome kind of dude in that, he's the bad
Lance
guy.
Guest.
Lance Guest is the bad guy in late phases where he just looks so, I hadn't
you
seen
You mean Lance
him,
Guest of Halloween 2 fame?
Yeah. But I mean,
Lance Guest of Jaws the Revenge fame?
But he's so good in late phases. He just comes in like you haven't seen him in like 20 years and he's great.
He is great in late phases.
Like really just like,
Lance Guest, who's under your bed right now?
I feel like he's in the room with us.
Rob's working as this marketing director.
Don't you remember me? Elvin Kane?
I guess not.
Under your bed.
I can remember Junkadoo, and I can't remember that.
Well, it was also a Night of the Comet. What's her face? Was the girlfriend in it?
Kathy.
Lance Guest was the girlfriend in it.
Clearly.
Speaking of people hiding under our bed, ready to murder us, Mike Williamson would murder all of us.
Oh, no.
He did not mention Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare.
Which does have a good video game segment, but then he ends up turning him to paper to kill him, which I was always...
That is a little weird.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I was always kind of like, okay, if he's in the Freddy...
You know what, I almost said...
No, because he did the game over.
The power,
am I forgetting that? He uses the power glove.
You're thinking of the comic book
sequence. I am thinking of the comic book one.
No,
thank you.
He just
I'm melding
him,
the two.
Yeah.
Right? And you see his stomach like going in and out.
Yep,
Breckin Meyer
makes the good
He's
noises.
Like, boink, 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 boink.
Yeah.
That's not the one I revisit the most. So
I am definitely that was one of my bold horror statements. Bold horror statements.
I was going to. Today is the day that Roseanne got fucking kicked off TV.
Good
riddance. But I pulled up a screen grab of her and Freddy's Dead, and I was going to tweet it out and CC Mike Williamson.
Nice. I do not hate Freddy's Dead. But that said, the video game segment's rocking because it does have the power glove, which was so of its time.
I just like seeing a little like, you know, version of Freddy that way, like as a little animated character. It was cool.
8-bit Jason, we still haven't had that. Haven't had a movie
but
that.
But we get 8-bit Jason on Friday the 13th video game.
Yeah. We sure do. Yeah. So speaking of, I know you play.
I played this weekend hard.
You played this weekend?
Man. Oh,
I haven't played it in a while. I haven't played it since they do the new... since they did like the solo campaign or any of that on there.
They're great.
I got to get on it. But do you guys play horror video games?
Yes.
I did a lot when I was in college. Like, honestly, I did. I played, I gamed just as much as I watched movies. Mm. So it was, I was really into puzzle games. So like Seventh Guest, 13th Hour, I destroyed any of the puzzle games. Dungeon Keeper, I was big into. Gabriel Knight, I'm really showing my time right now.
Yeah, Gabriel
Every
Knight.
Gabriel Knight. I mean, and that was much more of like a mystery game. with horror elements voiced by Tim Curry. I played all of those like back to back. Grim Fandango was another one that I just loved. I still have the soundtrack for that on my phone. I play it all the time. So
I did my fair share when I had the Sega Genesis. I mean, like, you know, Splatterhouse, all that stuff. But now I'm a frequent gamer. I mean, like, I do Friday the 13th. Evil Within.
The Evil Within is
Evil
great.
Evil Within was really cool.
And 2, I think it was Evil Within 2 that just came out last year. Until Dawn's also a favorite.
Until Dawn is wonderful.
That was great.
Yeah. That's great. Until Dawn's, I think we talked about Resident Evil. You played Resident Evil 7, right?
Yeah, I can't get through it because I'm too terrified.
I know, me too.
What is Until Dawn the Fessenden?
Yeah.
I really just want to watch some.
Really good.
I don't play those games, but I want to watch people play them so I can get the story part of it.
I think that Until Dawn is a great game for a non-gamer to get into because it's not, you're not like running and jumping and fighting stuff. Yeah. You are, you know, making decisions. And so it's really just an interactive movie it's great.
Because I love arcade games, but what happened is I noticed that if you stepped away from gaming for like 10 years, let's say, the interface of the pads are so complicated where you aim and walk.
I could never grasp the concept of first person perspective. Mm. Like the last game system I had was Super Nintendo where, you know, you run back and forth and jump up and down occasionally and that's it.
Yeah.
I remember going to my friend's house when he got Resident Evil and it was terrifying. It was fun to watch and sitting with him, but my brain just couldn't comprehend, like, wait, that little dots are supposed to be people around us or whatever. So like I can't get into first person games. So
yeah, no, arcade games always were my thing. I loved arcade games, but something about the home thing I could never adapt.
There was, did anyone ever play Rain?
Oh, yeah.
I loved that.
Wait, Rain? Heavy Rain?
It was just called Rain. It was a Japanese game.
Heavy Rain, the Christian Slater.
Hard Rain.
Hard Rain.
No, this was... This
Morgan Freeman. Heavy Rain is like similar to
Morgan Freeman.
No, this was a video game, and I never could understand why they didn't make it into a movie, but it was about a city where it is always raining, and the whole game takes place at night in the rain, but all of these invisible monsters come out at night, so you can't see them. It was intense. I loved that game so much. That was like a big one for me.
Yeah, they're... did you ever play the Thing video game?
So I didn't know there that, was one. Yeah, I'm at US Outpost 31.
Remember that?
Yeah. I remember that. Really? I never got a chance to play. Yeah,
what did it look like? What kind of graphics was it?
It was like PS2. PlayStation 1. PlayStation 1?
Yeah.
But it was, what I liked about it is they had like a system of trust that actually, as I recall, worked pretty well. Where you would, like, a zero was. If it was like a zero on the scale, then they would take a bullet for you, you know. But if it was a 5, they would like shoot you on sight.
Yeah.
And so it was about managing your trust with other people and other people's trust with you. And I read somewhere recently that they were going to do a sequel to it because it ends, you know, based on how you play the game differently from the movie, you know. And so they were going to do a sequel of it that would have been like, what happens after the final survivor? You know, where does that go? But I always remember liking that. I always thought that was like a pretty good movie adaptation.
I remember attempting to play it and then just not having – I think I borrowed a copy from somebody. I mean, like, games are fucking expensive. And when that came out when I just moved to L.A., I think. And I had to like sell a bunch of stuff just to get PlayStation because the Evil Dead game came out.
Oh,
remember the
yeah.
Evil Dead games? There was like a line of them. It was the very first one. And,
with like the midget demon that was running around.
That
with
was,
you?
I think, the second.
Oh, was that the second
I think
one?
That was the second one. The first one was just pure, you know, your Ash running around a cabin and stuff like that, and it was very difficult. And it was just, you know, after a while, it started getting a little tiresome because he kept saying the same shit over and over. So there's only so much of groovy and come get some you can hear. Uh-huh. We were like, Jesus Christ, let's just find new things to say. But that was a fun game. That was a fun one. That was really tough too. I'm trying to get into. I downloaded a bunch of stuff from Dead by Daylight. There were some new DLC things that I guess happened this week. But Dead by Daylight's a lot of fun because it's basically, it's like a single environment. You're kind of trapped in this kind of weird limbo state. And you're a survivor or a slasher and you got to run around and either kill people or survive. Yeah. But speaking to the kind of like first person thing, that's one game that it gets me very motion sick. And so I got to play it like in small bits and pieces, but you can download Michael Myers. You could play Leatherface. You could play, Jigsaw with the pig face.
Huh,
you could play Freddy Krueger. Yeah. So there's a lot of, for the diehard horror fans, there's a lot there.
And this is for Dead by Daylight?
Dead by Daylight. Okay. Yeah. Well, but I mean, the killers they created, they're all original villains. Like, you know, there's some really cool shit. shit. There's kind of like a J-horror inspired one. It's like a ghost that shrieks. She shrieks every time she chases you, and that's like the last thing you want to hear if you're just kind of moseying around. But it's really effective, really well done.
Did you guys ever play the Clive Barker video game Jericho?
Yeah.
I loved that
game. There was a Nightbreed one, too, that for the Amiga. I remember when it first came out, I remember before I saw the movie, the Amiga game had come out of Nightbreed, and I would kill to know what it was. It was like a media ROM from my memory. So
No, the Jericho one was later, and if I remember correctly, it was on, I remember playing it on my computer, I'm guessing, but it was about a military operation, and it was like hyper gory, and I remember that there was a lot of plot to it, and that was kind of the downfall of the game, was it was really plotty, but I remember it being a very standard Barker story with this crazy over-the-top gore and these creatures and heaven and hell and demons, and I remember it being hyper gory, as well as, did you guys ever play Phantasmagoria?
Oh yeah, sure.
That's another one. I actually, a couple of years ago, I was like, I want to make a movie version of Phantasmagoria, and somebody already has the rights and is working on a movie for it, but I always thought it looked cool.
I was correct about Nightbreed. We are looking at graphics of Nightbreed right now.
Just go on YouTube and you'll see the Nightbreed.
Oh my God. You are literally in Midian right now, walking around.
I want to play that. Because there's so many monsters, so many creatures you could choose.
Well, the funny thing is there was that came out during that era where there was like early 90s, so there was a lot of horror video games that were being showcased on the back of Fangoria magazine. Like, I remember there was when Pumpkinhead 2 Bloodwings came out, I remember it was like, play the CD-ROM game today. And I was like, oh man, I can't wait. And then I saw Pumpkinhead 2 Bloodwings, and I was like, I'm good. I do not need to spend $60
on
that.
It's possible that the video game is better than the movie.
I really want Nightbreed to be like Super Mario Brothers, but you can like, do you choose to be Pelequin? Yeah. Or, you know?
The one thing that's interesting, because those kind of games, I guess the difference is arcade games, it's you versus a game and it's a game. The others are like totally experiential things. Like, you're in the game. And thinking about that difference.
I'm sorry, you can find every one of these on YouTube. Yeah. I just did Pumpkinhead video game.
I found myself watching the walkthrough for Predator 2, which came out on Genesis. Oh. I have it, and I now have my Genesis. That I have a new like a Genesis, and I've been playing it and watching the dudes that do these kind of like playthroughs. They'll get the fucking game done in like 30 minutes. I sit there and I'm like, all right, I'm ready for Predator 2 to beat this. It takes me 15 minutes just to get through the first round because I keep dying.
Yeah, my parents still have the NES at the house. And so when I went home at Christmas time, I was trying to play the original Splatterhouse, and I still can't make it past the giant tongue. No matter what. I'm like, fuck all you people. I just can't.
You know what was a good one was Jurassic Park.
Yeah, because you could play as the raptor.
You could play as the raptor.
Oh, man. Yeah. Can you play as Sam Neill?
Yes, finally. You can play as Sam Neill and you can play as the Velociraptor.
Did any of you ever play the game Sanitarium?
No.
It was like a point-and-click adventure, and I don't know who made it. I can't, but I was obsessed with this game. Had really cool graphics for the time. It must have come out in like the late 90s. Yeah. It was like a top-down isometric thing where you were a guy in a mental asylum that ends up going like into these other worlds and having to – I can't exactly remember what you have to do. I just remember it was really cool, all the different worlds that you would have to go into. And then, of course, you know, at the end, oh, he's been in the mental asylum the whole time. But I just remember that being a really fun game. I was really obsessed with that one. The other one I wanted to mention was Manhunt.
You can now play Sanitarium on droids.
Rings a bell.
What's that?
You can now play Sanitarium on droids.
It has been ported
to droids.
Wow.
Droids.
Yes. Uh-huh. But yeah, Manhunt.
Manhunt. I remember Manhunt.
Manhunt was great. It was like a sort of a Running Man style thing, but much darker, where you would have to go and murder people. And
The cover had like a dude in like a hockey mask.
Because you say that.
Uh oh. He's got a. Uh-oh. Is it a Manhunt?
Skipper has props.
I've read he brought
theatrics going.
I figured.
I better get a photo, because in case we have to reference this.
I have things.
In our.
Oh, there it is.
He brought it. I remember that cover.
Come on.
This is great.
Manhunt, PlayStation 2.
PlayStation 2, Manhunt.
Got it.
It's a great game. It's super scary and super intense. I thought that this might help to spur our memories. Yeah. And because I'm a collector of video games and I have kept all of mine for always.
Oh man, he brought a ton.
Have you played the new Castlevania?
I have not played the new one.
It's not so good. Yeah. I didn't enjoy it. But
I'll
remember
wait till you have them all out.
Castlevania, I have to play this it was Gauntlet that I always played on tabletop, but I remember Castlevania very well as well.
I brought this one.
Dr.
Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, which has my favorite cover of all of them. But
yeah, I was going to say that. I know that artwork.
This game is terrible. It's a horrible game.
I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Zombie. Remember Zombies Ate My Neighbors?
Of course. Uh-huh.
I absolutely adore that, that game. I still have my original like Sega Genesis mint in package. Because I mean like I just kept it. It was the one game that's like, I mean, like when I die, I'll probably be holding the copy of this game. But it still has all my passwords scribbled down in 14-year-old Ryan Turk.
Oh my gosh.
Isn't that the best?
Yeah, it is great.
Of course, Friday the 13th.
Yeah. Nintendo.
He's literally pulling out the NES cartridges. Like, I feel compelled to blow on these things so they work.
You should. Touch this.
I've also got Gremlins 2, Nintendo game.
Yep. Is that with Leonard Maltin or Hogan?
I'm going to say Hogan.
Okay.
Maniac Mansion, which some of you might remember.
So this is another one that, this is behind the veil. A couple of years ago, I was like, you know what? I fucking love Maniac Mansion. I'm going to make this into a movie. The Purple Tentacle Shall Live Again. And I had this really cool concept for it. So I started investigating who owns the rights, and it's Disney. And so then I reached out to Disney and said, you own the rights to Maniac Mansion. And they said, we do. How about that? And then that was the end of the story.
Wow.
So, I love Maniac Mansion.
This is always a favorite. Fester's Quest.
Oh my God, I remember Fester's Quest.
Well, I remember that came out when the first movie came out, and yet he looks nothing like Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah, nothing at all.
Who is what the game has been, which is kind of like, you know, remember Batman Return of the Joker?
Yeah.
It's technically a sequel to the movie, and yet it doesn't look like
it looks more Terrifier to me.
Yeah.
I always remember from Fester's Quest the opening of it being that I thought it was hilarious that Fester was moonbathing. I always remember that being a very funny thing. Of course, Jaws, the video game.
And that's actually based on...
I don't know about that.
Based on Jaws, the Revenge.
Oh. Yes.
Because the plot is basically you're underwater or whatever... But the ending of the game is you have to make him freak out so he jumps out of the water and does the line roar.
You pick up flares.
You stab him with the tip of the boat.
It's incredibly hard.
I'd pay $1,000 to watch Michael Caine play that game.
I could beat this game right now.
Really?
I'll pay $1,000 to watch Elric stab a shark with the tip of his boat.
I could beat the Jaws video game right now.
I want to see Elric stab Michael
Caine. Until you get to the level where the jellyfish go in diagonal, that one kind of sucks, but I could beat this game right now. I have played that thing so much. I will get the and I will be at level 7, which is what you need to stab him with the boat in no time.
I've never seen her so fired up about anything.
I also brought
N64 Hexen.
Hexen.
Remember this?
Oh my God, yes.
This was a Doom port that was, but you played as like evil wizards and evil knights and like a dark... like a dark fantasy universe.
One of the ones that's on the Nintendo thing that I bought that came out during Christmas, it's got like 14, 15, or 20 games or whatever, is... Oh, no, it's on the Genesis. It's on the Genesis that I bought. It's Decap Attack. Remember Decap Attack? You're like a mummy, but you've got like a head in your belly.
Oh, yeah.
And then it would like, you would hit a the B button, and then the head would come out of the belly people.
Yes. Is this the one with Krang? Was that the name of it? I remember
Krang's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
And he had a giant tongue in belly. Yeah. Okay, I played that one as well.
Yeah, but you would run around, and you would like try to get a skull. And put it on your body, your decapitated body, and then you would run around and throw your skull every once
in a while. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Decap Attack was good times.
I always thought this was a very cool one. Taboo the Sixth Sense.
That's
for Nintendo.
Judged by its cover.
This is a tarot card reading. It's like a Ouija board Nintendo game.
Wow. It looks like a self-help thing.
It is a little bit.
Jesus. Oh, don't
it's like
throw
the
Maniac
secret,
Mansion.
Arcade version of the
and
secret.
Then I'll end with the scariest one of all, Cliffhanger on the Sega Genesis.
Oh, my God.
I like that we started with Stallone.
Stallone.
We're coming back to Stallone.
Always back to Stallone.
On brand.
I want to play Maniac Mansion right now.
I think Demolition Man would make a really good video game. Arcade
Demolition
game.
Man is
they probably
a video
made, I'm
game.
Sure they made one of it.
Yeah, I think
you go to Taco Bell in it.
Genesis the B buttons, the three seashells, boom. Well, I was going to say, you know, the difference between these games, are you're playing them and your game, your thing is the other games are more experiential, and yours is weird because arcade games I don't think of that way, but you've made a movie that takes what's become popular with experiential play and put it into a arcade game, which is like you trying to beat the game, and you've merged those two, I think, two different almost generations of gaming into one into your movie, because it's really about him experiencing going in to the game in the way that you would go into kind of first-person games. You know?
Yeah. No, thanks. Yeah,
that's my thesis.
This is
and I have now retired it.
This is Elric bringing it back around.
Yeah, no, thank you.
It was a desperate attempt.
Yeah. No,
but I do think you did that, and I probably unconsciously, but it's probably a result of growing up on these and then playing these first-person experiential games for years. You know, it wouldn't maybe be enough to just have someone playing an arcade game anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I was reflecting, you know, as I was coming over here on why, you know, what is it about video games and especially about horror and video games? Like you said, Ryan, there's, you know, there are all these video game adaptations based on horror movies, and it's sort of like why are we obsessed with that? Yeah. You know, and I'm not exactly sure of the answer, but it's something about having to, it's like, I feel like when you're watching a horror movie, you know, you are constantly thinking, what would I do?
Yeah.
You know, what would I do in this situation? And I think that's why we're sort of obsessed with the idea of actually getting to step into that role, you know, and play a game like this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
and maybe for cynics, because I think as horror fans, we are now like not that scared of even really good, scary horror movies. But I've sat watching someone play, I can't remember, I think it was the one, it was the last version of Silent Hill that got pulled. Mm-hmm. It became the legal one.
Oh, and I was watching the Guillermo thing.
Yeah, and I watched Ben and Luke and like play it, and I was kind of freaked out.
Yeah.
Because it was just you going down a dark hole and weird things happening. It was like, this is scarier than a movie. So maybe it's us chasing that dragon now when we're, you know.
I think it's definitely that as I get older playing video games. I know when I was a teenager, it was just a sense of escape. And to kind of get one step closer to the things that I was loving, which was film. So playing, you know, Friday the 13th, or playing especially Jurassic Park, and I was obsessed with the Batman Returns Genesis game, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, what I would enhance it by throwing in the Danny Elfman score and then just playing that way, you know, or putting on John Williams, you know, the Jurassic Park score and just playing Jurassic Park that way, you know? I remember my dad walking in, and I've got the score blasting on CD, and he's like, he was sees me playing the video game, and he just shook his head and walked back out. Just a silent, like, all right, you're taking it one step far. But yeah, that's what it was always for me. But, you know, I think
and they're
now
cinematic now, too. They're very
super cinematic. So. Exactly.
Well, I mean, the only, like, I don't get scared from horror films very easily now. But horror video games sure do affect me still. Mm. You know, like the, you know, Alien Isolation totally got me. Resident Evil 7 totally got me.
Yeah.
Bloodborne is another great one.
I couldn't get into it. I was just talking to Brian Collins about this. I cannot get into it.
It's good. I mean, I haven't been able to beat it because it's super hard.
Yeah.
There's a great game on PSVR that is called, I keep wanting to say The Evil Within, but it's not The Evil Within. Oh, I should have looked it up. But it's like a black and white. It's all black and white, and you're going through basically an afterlife, and you're trying
to know
what I'm talking about?
Yep.
And that, again, it's truly, like, disturbing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, what you said, Elric, about you're chasing the dragon, I think that's true. You know, we're always trying to figure out what's the next thing that's going to really get us.
Yeah.
There's something about games that it covers both the bases of it's scary and it's fun.
Yeah, I agree.
And in your case, you can fuck it.
And you can fuck it.
Well, on that note, Graham, thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for joining us,
some
Graham.
Show and tell for us.
Yeah.
And since Elric did it to me, I can't end the show.
Wait, that was
don't
perfect.
Don't let him get a good outro.
Exactly, asshole.
I can never actually, top that.
It was Ryan's outro. Now I got to fuck you over.
All right.
We can't end the show without, even if we don't talk about it, I just have to say evil speak.
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
We didn't get to talk about it.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Evil.
Because that's a game from actual hell, right? The actual game itself. Yeah, that's pretty rad. And great
and
graphics.
Clint Howard.
Yeah. Somebody should make the game of that. That game would be fun to play.
Right?
The Evil Speak.
All I remember is the little demon face on the computer. I don't remember the actual game. I got to go back and watch it again.
Oh, and the Hellraiser about online, where they play the Hellraiser game.
What's
the
Hellworld?
Hellworld. Oh. Lance Henriksen.
Pinhead goes to the internet.
Yeah.
Now you can end
now, do we have to end on Hellworld and you can fuck it.
Yeah.
Later.